Senate Agriculture and Veterans Budget and Policy Committee will come to order. Members, we're going to start right on time, whether there's one or none in this business, because if you want to stay after 5:30, I can stay as late as you want to, but I'd like to get out of here at a decent time. So if we can start right on three, it'd be nice. First, I'm Senator Jim Vickerman. I think most of you know me. I chair this committee. And I'm going to start to my left and go down and introduce yourself all the way down and come back, and so we get to know who. There's new people here. Michaels.
Hi, I'm Tim Michaels. I'm the committee administrator.
Sandy Brown as a legislative assistant.
Senator Keith Langseth.
Satvir Chaudhary, Senate District 50.
Bill Ingerson, Senate District 11.
Senator Paul Coring, Brainerd, Little Falls, former dairy farmer of 15 years. I need to show the secret dairy farmer handshake to Senator Chaudhary. So.
I don't even know what that is. And I was at it a lot longer than you were. Still at it.
Senator Sharon Erickson Ropes from Winona, Senate District 31.
You're the new vice chair.
Yes, sir.
Dan Mueller, I'm the fiscal analyst for the committee.
Greg Knopf, legislative analyst with Senate Council Research and Fiscal Analysis.
And I'm Tom Bodern, Senate Counsel for the committee.
Well, members, the real power are these three gentlemen. They need to get us more than $0 in this budget business, so we'll see how they can do it. We have one more person, our clerk. Bill, do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Bill. I'm the committee page.
I'll be sharing Bill, our clerk, with the tax committee between the two of us. We'll be working back and forth to try to cut down numbers.
And Mr. Chairman, our Republican staffer is Ken over here. Ken,
sure. Okay. Did I miss anybody? If not, I think we'll start right out. My first on the list is Commissioner Hugesson. I've known Gene for a long, long time, and a lot of the older members probably already know who he is. But Gene, why don't you come up and give us a rundown on the Department of Agriculture.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm Gene Hugesson, Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today to share perspective as it relates to the bioenergy and what we've been doing in Minnesota up to this point. Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, and I think part of what you were interested in is to have a history of what's gone on in this state up to this point, and then spend some time talking about the governor's perspective in terms of where we're going from here. If it's okay with you, what I will do is I will go through the history part first and then let some of the others testify with their part, and then come back later on towards the end more with kind of the perspective in terms of where we see things going from here.
That's fine, Mr. Hughes.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, what I'd like to do is just as briefly as possible, but yet as complete and succinctly as possible, to give an outline to you in terms of where we are in the state of Minnesota as it relates to renewable fuels. Currently, we have 16 ethanol plants in Minnesota. They do have a total production of about 620 million gallons. The interesting thing, though, is that we have a number of other plants that are under construction and or have been permitted to be constructed, so that we have actually an additional capacity of another 450 million gallons online, which will put us over the 1 billion gallon a year capacity in this state. That amount would probably be $1 billion, then 1 billion gallons out of a total U.S. Production of about 8 to 9 billion gallons. So as you can see, that's a significant part of really what the total national production of ethanol will be at that point. In Minnesota, it generates about $2.8 billion in terms of revenue for our economy. That comes from the 10,000 jobs at the ethanol plants themselves. But certainly there's a lot of other jobs that are created as a spinoff from that. There's probably about 18,000 jobs total, so 10,000 actual workers plus another 8,000. That results in a total economic benefit of about $5 billion. Now, out of this, too, what we should consider is that these ethanol plants are using over 15% of the state's corn crop. When we are at the billion-gallon projection, we will probably be at about 20% of the state's corn use going into ethanol production. But certainly, ethanol is not the only story. We also are heavily involved in biodiesel. And at this particular point, we are generating amounts of biodiesel at $928 million coming from the 63 million gallons that we're capable of producing in Minnesota from the three plants that we have up and running. Two of those plants are our larger soybean facilities. The third one is a smaller facility that actually has a capacity of doing both soybeans, but also is very involved in recycling food grease, deep fryer grease. It's the type of stuff that you can drive behind the bus and smell French fries from, that kind of a situation. Now, the ethanol and the renewable fuels industry has done a huge benefit as it relates to our rural economy. When you look at what's happened out there, it's given the farmers that are involved with these kinds of plants, and even now more recently, all farmers in general, some economic benefit. But for those farmers that were owners in these ethanol plants, we're looking at a situation that certainly provided a hedge for their crop prices. Many of those farmers are active owners of these facilities. At one time, we had 8,000 members, farmer-owned members, in co-op plants in ethanol in Minnesota. And when you consider that we got about 80,000 farmers, we're talking about 10% of the farmers in Minnesota at one time owned stock in ethanol plants. And I say at one time because in some cases, some of those plants have turned around and been sold off. One case, not necessarily willingly, but in another case, because of some farmers saw some economic opportunities in doing so. So as a result, we don't have that many farmers involved at this particular point, but at one time we were as high as 8,000 farmer members. So all in all, as it relates to the corn, it's probably added at least $1.74 to the value of that corn from the stock that farmers held in these particular facilities. Now, if you followed what's happened with the markets here lately, and it really is very unusual in the sense that it started in even while harvest was going on, so that the ethanol plants and the prospect of more ethanol plants caused grain prices to literally double this year compared to what they were last year. And so we're seeing quite an unusual phenomenon in the rural economy, not only in Minnesota, but really throughout the United States, as it relates to these ethanol plants particularly, creating a lot of demand. So that, and I mention that because for many years, farmers were saying, what's in this for me? Because unless they had stock in ethanol plants themselves, they were not necessarily seeing the benefit that it was coming to them personally. Now, all of a sudden, beginning about in October of this last year, suddenly the increase in prices has really come back to benefit certainly the corn farmers. But then what's also happened is that because next year it's expected that the corn prices will generate more acres going into corn, we're seeing then likewise increase in soybean prices because the anticipation of less soybean acres. Also, wheat prices have gone up because of the same sort of situation. In fact, I had somebody tell me that edible bean prices were going up because they were fearful that the corn acres would take over some, or corn, some of these farmers would switch from edible beans to corn. So it's having a kind of a ripple effect out in the farm community in terms of the prices that certainly have been generated. And last Friday, if you paid any attention to the markets, I think beans were up 42 cents and corn was up 20 cents, which is unheard of this time of the year for that sort of thing to be happening. Now, where are we today as it relates to some of the going on a little farther? One of the things, of course, that Minnesota has been very active in is in the use of E85. E85, of course, is a fuel blend that's used and available for flex fuel vehicles, meaning that it's up to 85% of that fuel blend is ethanol, the other 15%, of course, being straight gasoline. But as you might guess, E85 is only as good as what you've got vehicles that can use it in the first place, having access to stations that sell it in the second place. So you need the combination of the two together to really make that program successful. As a result of that, we've got a situation in Minnesota that we're a little over 300 stations now that offer E85, and that's quite significant when you consider that in the whole United States, there's only about 1,000 stations altogether. Interestingly, I was at a conference in Washington last Friday, and a fellow from California followed me, and he admitted that California had recently doubled their E85 stations in California. They went from one to two, and that's all the whole state of California. So obviously, we're a little bit ahead of where they are in that state. We're currently seeing about 120,000 vehicles in Minnesota that are driving E85 stations. I think you're aware that in 2005, many of you were here and voted for the proposal that required Minnesota to be the first state to require a 2% biodiesel in all the diesel fuel that's sold in Minnesota. And certainly that has had a significant impact in terms of the forward thinking of where we're going to go with that whole program as well. You may recall we had some hiccups last winter. We think those, for the most part, have been taken care of, and we've got great cooperation going on between the blenders that are using the blending the product together with those plants that are producing the product, and obviously wanting to make sure that we are doing everything we can to assure the public that we've got a quality product. We're going through a cold snap now, so this will be a good test to see if, in fact, that is an issue, because certainly, if you're familiar with the biodiesel situation, biodiesel, when it's in its pure form, that is B100, has to be kept heated when it gets below a certain temperature, below the freezing temperature. And so once it's blended and blended correctly, then it doesn't need to be heated anymore. But one of the things we'll be watching and doing some testing in Minnesota to see is how high can you, in fact, go with that blend to be in a situation that it still is a usable product. Certainly, the E10, that requirement that Minnesota has in place in Minnesota, the E85 situation that we've got, the biodiesel situation that we have as well, is doing what we can to reduce our share of dependence on foreign oil, because certainly that's been an issue. And I'll get into another issue here in just a little bit. But let me back up just a little bit more and run through quickly some history that brought us up to where we are right now. Senator Vickerman mentioned we go back a ways. Senator Dill, Senator Vickerman, and myself all started in the legislature at the same time back in 1987, and that was about the same time that all of this was really getting going. Now, there'd been a little bit done before that, back in, I think it was about 1980, in which a 4 cents per gallon blender's credit was put in place to encourage the use of the stations to have the use of 10% ethanol. But it really wasn't until we got into the late 80s and we had the program in place of having the producer payment that encouraged the construction and building of ethanol plants in Minnesota, that particularly those that were geared toward farmer ownership, that we really saw this program take off. And so as a result, we saw a huge investment go into play by the hands of farmers themselves. The lending institutions, which are up to that point had been hesitant to look at getting into some of the financing because they were not real convinced that it was risk-worthy. With the state program in place of supplying up to 20 cents a gallon per year, $3 million maximum per year, $30 million total over the 10-year period, now saw this as a pretty much a good price guarantee that they would, in fact, get paid for their investment. And so as a result, we got to the point where we are today of having 16 plants in Minnesota. And even though the program, as you may be aware, has been capped at this point and it's not in place anymore, other than to finish out our commitment to those that started the program, we still are seeing ethanol plants being funded without that in place, simply because the lending institutions recognize that this is something that we do have going for us. One of the key elements, though, to the whole program's success, I think for those of us that watch this grow, has to do with the collaboration, the cooperation, really the different synergies that came together to make this program successful. And one of them had to do with that this was not only a rural economic development because of the problems of the 80s back in agriculture, but it was also seen as a very real plus for the urban environment. And it was with the metro legislators coming together with rural legislators in supporting this, together with the Clean Air Act that came about at this time, and some of the air emission problems of the Twin Cities area not being able to meet the EPA's attainment goals, that resulted in Minnesota taking this and really going forward in such a way that made this program successful. The other thing that was, I think, very unique to Minnesota, because others have tried to do some things. Minnesota was certainly has led the way in the past, and I would argue continue to lead the way. Was that the fact that Minnesota was the only state that even to now has addressed both the supply issue and the demand issue at the same time. In other words, we had the producer payment there to provide the incentive to build the plants in the first place, but we also had the 10% mandate there to require a market for it in the other end. So it was a case of bringing both the supply and the demand together and making that program work in such a way that many states now have copied parts of the program, but not necessarily all of the program. The Department of Agriculture has really been a lead agency in this going back from the beginning and continues to be involved, but we do have other partners with us as well. And I'll just run through a few of the things that we certainly are doing or we have involvement with. We are have been responsible for the producer payments that have gone out to the stations that are qualify for this, and so we've paid out a significant amount of dollars, some years up to as high as $36 million in payments to these plants. And so that has been part of what we've been involved with. We certainly have worked with getting the farmer ownership with this program as well. Together with the legislature's involvement, we've had a program in place that actually loaned farmers money to buy stock in some of these farmer-owned ethanol plants to begin with, which certainly has helped shape that whole situation in place. We've also worked with some of the rural communities in terms of trying to make sure that they understood all the things that were involved in putting together ethanol plants. Many of you know Ralph Groshen and his work that he's done with ethanol right from the beginning. He's, in essence, been sort of Mr. Renewable Fuels in Minnesota and has done a great job. We've had other staff members that have kind of come on board and assisted and helped in those areas as well. But certainly Ralph has been very much a key instrumental in doing some of these things to begin with and continues to do so as well. One of the other things that we did in the agency that I think was very important along the way was that we had a program created called the Ethanol Answer Man. You may recall that when the 10% requirement first went into play, there was quite a bit of resistance. And oftentimes it was through ignorance or people not understanding what the situation was. I would suggest, and maybe it's overgeneralization on my part and not fair, but I think we had cases of mechanical problems not being able to be diagnosed, and so it was blamed on ethanol. And a situation where really we had Ralph and others on staff that would take the time to answer people's question by phone, literally one-on-one, and walk them through some of the issues that needed to be worked with. We've started out with some less than enthusiastic support from some of the industry folks. Today that has turned around for the most part, and we've had a good cooperation from some of the engine manufacturers. We have seen, I think, even of recent months, how the car manufacturers have gone from almost a kind of a not paying much attention to renewables to all of a sudden advertising gas pumps in the fuel pumps in the cornfields and those kinds of things, where suddenly it becomes now very important and very proper to be advocating and pushing ahead with this whole issue. Also, interestingly, and I don't think it's totally out of school to talk about some of the major problems that Detroit has had, where one of the major automobile manufacturers is actually looking in better financial shape right now because of some of their leadership in renewables compared to one of the others that sort of let some of this lag by the wayside. And so as a result, it's suddenly become very, very important thing to do to be advocating the kinds of things to do with renewable fuels. And certainly Minnesota has been very instrumental in helping us to get in that particular situation. One of our obviously key partners in all of this, what we're doing, is from the Department of Commerce. Mike Bull, one of the assistant commissioners there that heads up this whole area, was not able to be here today, and that's the reason I've been doing the presentation here by myself. But certainly from the Department of Commerce's standpoint, their major role in all of this has been to obviously ensure the quality of the product that's coming out of the gas pumps. And so they make sure that if it says 10% ethanol, that stations are following that. If it's an E85, the same sort of thing. Biodiesel quality issues have been their responsibility, and we've had a great working relationship with them. Likewise, as it relates to some of the E85 programs, even though we administer the dollars, together with the Minnesota Clean Air Association, and that's one organization that we need to point out, the Minnesota Lung Association, for the great work that they've done and the great cooperation that they've had in helping us to achieve some of these roles that we've had there as well. So people at in Commerce, the Weights and Measures Division, have all been important in this whole area as well. Likewise, the Pollution Control Agency has got heavily involved with these whole issues as it relates to permitting and siting ethanol plants. And while they've often been sort of chastised in the sense that things haven't moved ahead as quickly as some people would like them to see, people need to remember, of course, that Minnesota has some very stringent environmental rules, and so these types of things have to be followed. The PCA has to go through and work with all the plant proposers to make sure that these things are done in such a way that it certainly works out in a way that is beneficial to the state as a whole, but can help these plants get up and running as quickly as possible. Department of Employment and Economic Development, DEED, certainly has been involved with this a lot, and a lot of the some of the Job Z programs that are in place right now have benefited some of the newer ethanol plants that don't have the 20-cent subsidy that the original ones had, have used that as well. And certainly we'd be remiss not to mention the non-government partners that have been involved with this. To begin with, the Minnesota Corn Growers, that membership did a tremendous job in getting the ball rolling. Minnesota Soybean Folks and the Growers Association and Consul for the work that was done in the biodiesel area as well. So, Mr. Chairman, that sort of brings us up to where we are right now today. I've got some other things to talk about in terms of where we go from here. But I would just summarize this particular point by saying that Minnesota is still undisputedly seen as the national leader among the states in terms of what's going on in renewable fuels. It's very interesting when I saw a presentation that somebody was doing as they were going around the country. They were using some of the same slides we've been putting out showing what's done here in Minnesota, and they were touting the Minnesota model as it relates to renewable fuels. So we have certainly set up a program that many are choosing to emulate. I didn't realize how much this was all of a sudden attracting national attention until a conference I spoke at last winter out west, and the first person to greet me off the podium after I finished speaking was a banker from Wall Street. And he was there simply because all of a sudden the Wall Street investors saw ethanol and the renewable fuels things that were going on as something that certainly tweaked their interest, and they saw it as something that would definitely have a future in Minnesota. Now, as it relates to that, and certainly the President's State of the State address last winter also generated a bunch of interest, and some of the things that have come out of that since having to do with looking at the biomass and where we go with cellulosic are some things I'll talk about later, but I know some of the other presenters will mention those as well, and I'll be glad to come back and touch on that. But, Mr. Chairman, maybe if there's some questions right now that you'd like to touch on, I'd be glad to.
I have just two quick questions. And one has to do with E85 pump.
Yes.
Nothing upsets people in my district, and they got to drive 30 miles to the pump. I checked into it. Big oil companies won't let them put a pump in there because they don't pump enough. That's going to change, though, with the new flex fuels and people that are, because they're going to go after the money if they possibly can. Second thing that I hear about is the price. It can be 15 cents. It can be 30 cents. It's all over. Depends on what station that you pull into. And I want to take a serious look at that, see what we need to do about that. If we need to put more money into some of these small stations, we did put some, but we could put some more in there to encourage more pumps. But it's nice to talk about the price, the high price of corn. I know what Langstaff's going to say, it's killing his dairy operation, and I've got hog producers that are saying, holy cow, we're slipping here. Corn, I think, went up 20 or 30 cents, stays up about $4 or better, isn't it already, Commissioner?
It's in Chicago price, yes.
And that's not going to come down for, I'd say, a year or two. So that's something else that we're trying to help both sides here. It puts a real hardship on some.
Mr. Chair, you're exactly right. I would caution people, though, to be a little skeptical about that price staying way up there for a long period of time, because part of the thing that's keeping it up there right now is there's a lot of fund investors that are in the market, and these are fellows that are speculating based on it, and if all of a sudden they change their minds, we could see some change. I don't think we're going to see $2 corn again for quite some time. But I, in terms of everybody's being able to count on $4 and $5 corn, I would caution my farmer friends, and myself included, because I've gotten caught in this myself, to make sure that people are very little careful in terms of how they look at that.
Sure. I'm going to go to Senator Langstaff, if you're next.
Then. I've heard about on-farm biodiesel processing. There's some equipment now that a farmer can have that where he can get the biodiesel right on his farm. What do you know about that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Langseth, I'm not aware of in terms of actually producing the biodiesel on farm. What I am aware of is that a number of farmers, rather than buy the diesel fuel blend from their suppliers at 2%, are actually blending on their own at a higher percentage. And I've heard of farmers blending as high as 50%. Now, that is obviously farmers doing that at their own risk because most warranties won't go that high, and certainly as it relates to time of the year, that could be an issue as well. On the other hand, though, it is not uncommon for many farmers to be looking at a 10, 15, 20% blend in which they will have their supplier deliver onto their farm both the biodiesel and the regular diesel so that they achieve that higher blend and are, in fact, reporting no problems whatsoever and as they do this, recognizing, of course, that it's probably being done in a warmer climate time of the year as opposed to the winter.
Senator Coring.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. As we see these new plants come online, let me back up a second. I went to the Central Minnesota Ethanol Co-op's annual meeting on Saturday, which is in my district, and talked to the folks up there and talked to the corn buyer. She's paying $3.51 right now, and they are scrambling at this time to try to make sure that they have enough corn. And so she said that they're concerned about Fergus Falls going online and tapping into what they have. And as you know, up in Little Falls, that isn't necessarily corn country. So do you think that this is going to have a huge impact with these other plants going online to affect the other profitability of the other plants? I guess it's something that I'm concerned about.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Coring, certainly it is something that I think needs to be watched. And I think we're starting to see some back off as it relates to some of the things that were talked about at one point. But we need to remember, though, that Minnesota is not the only one involved with this sort of thing. I think interestingly, we may see some more back off in Minnesota than we may see some of the surrounding states. My understanding right now is that South Dakota has enough ethanol plants either online or coming with ones that are up in production and coming online that will make them a corn deficit state where they will literally have to import corn to keep their ethanol plants going. That is perhaps not the wisest thing to be doing. Now, as it relates to where we are in Minnesota, certainly the issue is somewhat mitigated in the sense that the byproducts that come from or the co-products that come from ethanol production can also be used as animal feed. So it's not like this corn is all being lost to the production of ethanol. It still can be used. Certainly, though, as we look down the line, I think it behooves all of us to realize that ethanol is made from corn is probably not the final answer. I see it as a transition to where we go. I think we're always going to be able to use corn for ethanol, at least to a certain extent, and that we will probably see prices stay really quite good for some time being. But I think it's the other thing that we need to strongly look at from the state level, and I know it's what I'll be talking about in the latter part of my presentation, and I think the other presenters will too, that we need to be looking at other sources for our ethanol production besides just corn, and that's where the cellulosic conversion certainly makes a lot of sense.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Commissioner, just to kind of follow a little bit on Senator Coring's questions, but I've been told, and I don't know if this is correct, you can correct me, that an acre of corn produces about 250 gallons. That's correct, maybe it isn't, but I'd like to know what that number is, and related to that, how many acres of corn we're looking at this and looking at additional plants coming under production, how do we know that we're not approaching that deficit status? And what is that going to do? We've got some competition right now for that resource. How much do we want to, at a state level, put in place incentives to choose one use rather than another, or we want to let that be more the decision of producers? So, do you have any information about the amount of corn we grow and how much of that goes to ethanol and how many gallons of ethanol we actually get from an acre?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, it could have been before you came in the room, but I went through the figures and mentioned that currently we're somewhat over 15% of the state's corn crop goes into ethanol production. When the new plants that are online to be built that will be put us at over the billion gallon a year production capacity in the state, we will be using about 20% of the corn crop in Minnesota for ethanol. You know, the other thing, though, to remember is that, you know, there's going to be some market reactions here from where this goes over the next few years. There's no doubt about it. And there's a lot of things that can create market volatility, and certainly this is one. And granted, for users, it's always an issue, and that's why I guess some of the precautionary kinds of things buyers can use are certainly important. But every year we see the yield capacity of corn go higher. I only look at these last 2 years in which we were facing major drought considerations in the state. And to turn around and look that we've had either near record or close to record corn crops in spite of those conditions tell me that the genetics of the new corn breeds that are out there are nothing short of phenomenal. And those yields are going to continue to go higher. Now, will they keep pace at the rate in which these ethanol plants are continuing to grow? Probably not. But I do think what we are seeing, though, is we are starting to see some drawback in some of the proposals' interest within Minnesota. And again, as I mentioned earlier, it's a little ironic in the sense that the state that was pushing for ethanol plant constructions to begin with might be one of the first states to actually start to reconsider some of these in the future. I can point out a very personal example very close to home, what's going on with the ethanol construction situation. I live in Martin County and actually continue to farm there. But this is the largest hog-producing county in the state, so there's a very large demand for corn with ethanol. There are two ethanol plants that are proposed to being built. In fact, work has already begun. Two 100-million-gallon facilities. Each of them, 100 million gallons, built 5 miles apart. And one of those alone will use all the corn grown in the county. So, you know, that does create some issues. And it certainly, as you might guess, got some hog farmers a bit concerned. I have a brother that's a hog producer, and so I hear about it, you know, firsthand, and I can relate to that. And as others of you have as well. But I also think, and I'm meeting with some of the lending institution folks here in the next week or so, too, to get kind of their perspective on these issues, because they're starting to look at this issue in terms of how do we, you know, how much do we overextend ourselves, and we do need to be careful as we look at this issue. Certainly some of the environmental considerations in terms of ethanol plant constructions have come into play on this whole issue. So they are getting more scrutiny than they were at one time.
Any other questions? Senator.
Thank you, Chairman and Commissioner. These plants, as they're being built, is there going to be a huge retooling as we get better at producing ethanol with other products, or are they close already?
That's Scogan. Mr. Chairman, Senator Scogan, every ethanol plant that's been built in Minnesota has been a little different than the one before. They keep modifying the technology as they learn from previous constructions. Part of that is in terms of the process and how they convert the corn into ethanol. Part of it is in the fuel that they use to fuel the project as well. We've gone from complete natural gas to be looking at some other products in terms of what they call gasification, taking some other material and creating the energy that's needed. In some cases, it's using actually the byproducts from the ethanol processing itself. One facility has been looking at, or is actually being built using coal with the idea that that could be used, could be switched over to use some of the biomass material as well. The Little Falls plant that Senator Corrigan was at, they're using some timber and wood waste product in terms of fueling that product. Fueling the process in terms of producing the ethanol, but they're all looking at you know where they go from. And let me say it this way: I think the first proposals for cellulosic ethanol conversion in the state will actually be being done by existing ethanol plants as they convert into some of these other methods as well. One of the major
ethanol designer builders in the region is actually doing a pilot project in northwest Iowa. But it's at a plant very similar to ones that we have in Minnesota, in which they will be using the corn stover, the corn stalks, from the land that they get the corn off of to likewise produce ethanol. So it'll be a combination of the acres that are used to produce 100 million gallons of corn ethanol will be used to produce about 30 million gallons of corn stover ethanol. And so we're going to continue to see this evolve on a somewhat regular basis. The one thing we need to remember, though, is that we are still several years away from seeing cellulosic ethanol production done in a cost-effective manner as where we are with corn ethanol today. So it's a transition. We're moving in there, but we're not there yet.
Senator Larry. Senator Scoy.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I think you might have answered part of my question, but it was along the same lines as what Senator Scogin just asked. But can a corn ethanol plant be retooled to be a cellulosic ethanol plant?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, I get a little dangerous when I start to try to answer technical questions, considering I'm a history major, not an engineer of any sort. But my understanding is it depends somewhat on how the plant was designed in the first place, that in terms of how much retooling or how much changes would have to be made. Yes, there certainly would have to be additional equipment built. There'd have to be changes made. For instance, this plant that I referenced down in northwestern Iowa, they're talking about several hundred million dollars of retrofit to that, simply because it's the first one that they would be doing. Now, the idea is that once they get up and doing some of this sort of thing, the cost will come down considerably. But to begin with, it will be quite an issue. There's a lot of excitement about cellulosic, and I'm getting ahead of myself here a little bit, perhaps in terms of my comments later. But it will change how we make ethanol, because it's easier to haul corn into a facility to get 1,000 gallons of ethanol than it is to haul the amount of corn stover it will take to make that equal amount of ethanol into that same facility. So there's going to have to be some, we're going to be looking at some different dynamics when we look at where we go with all this.
Senator Scoy.
And Mr. Chair and Commissioner, and then with that additional cost in mind, has the department or you had any thought about extending the corn ethanol payments to cellulosic ethanol?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, yes. And I would suggest that you will see some issues that will be proposed in the governor's budget that will be coming out next week that will address something in this area.
Thank you.
Members, we need to move along, but farmers, and I'm one of them, we think differently. When I went home 2 weeks ago, corn started getting up towards $4. Every farmer was going to plant twice as much corn. Now they figured out soybeans are going to come up. Cheaper to raise soybeans, so maybe we'd make just as much money if we stayed in soybeans. So I don't know if there's going to be a big shift in corn.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Vickerman, I think you're exactly right, because that's the same thing I thought. I've still got some soybeans I haven't sold yet, and I've not sold them for that very reason, because I think we're going to see some soybean prices jump based on that that very logic. So, but I always tell people, don't market according to me. If you do, market opposite, because if I sell, obviously hold.
Thank you, Commissioner. You're going to stick around.
I'll stick around.
We're going to move along, and I'm going to ask two people to come up together. Mr. Al Levine, Dean of College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Science, University of Minnesota, if he would come forward, along with Dr. Robert Eldy, I think I spelled it right, Dean of U of M College of Biological Science and Chair of the Executive Committee for the U of M Initiative for Renewable Energy and Environment, IREE. Welcome to the committee, and we kind of got ahead, but we're working in the direction that Senator Scoy wants to do, because that is going to be there in time. So you two, anytime you're ready, we're ready to go.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members, guests. I'm Alan Levine, a new dean, started November 13th of a new college, the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences. Our college, as you heard from the commissioner, of the kinds of complexity that's involved in this new mission around renewable energy, is deeply involved in all of these issues. As I run around the state, meet with commodity groups, or go out to our regional outreach centers, I immediately get questions about renewable energy, biodiesel, biofuels, cellulosic, black liquor, all sorts of compounds. You know, I started out as a food guy. I came over after 26 years with the Department of Veterans Affairs, running the research service there, to a department head in food science and nutrition, and now a dean of a newly organized college that has all aspects of it that are deeply involved in this. We have the applied economic aspect of this as well. All of this changes. Our food supply is going to get affected. Maybe that's a good thing. I'm director of the Minnesota Obesity Center. 66% of us are overweight. If our food goes up in price a little, perhaps that's a good thing at some level. But today I'm just here to introduce myself since I started new at this job. I'm part of the executive committee of which Dean Eldy is the head of the IRE group. And we're here to discuss today the kind of work that's going on at the University of Minnesota, not only on ethanol and biofuels, but also in terms of other alternative ways. Our school, for example, has forestry involved, the Forest Resources Group. Paper and wood are very interested in this area as well because of the lignin and the black liquor gasification programs that are involved. So every aspect of our economy is being affected in a major way by these new sources of fuels for us. So at this point, I think I'll turn over for a formal presentation to Dean Eldy, who's going to tell you about some of the work that's going on at the University of Minnesota, and we also have some technical people here as well with us.
Thank you very much. I'm Robert Eldy, Dean of the College of Biological Sciences and Chair of the Executive Committee for our University's Initiative in Renewable Energy and the Environment. We got off to a very strong start. You and your colleagues 4 years ago authorized the payment to the University of Minnesota, what has turned out to be $20 million over this four years, extends into next year as well, the set-aside from Xcel Energy's ratepayers. We've invested those resources into 115 grants. Some of those have been small-scale grants, others larger-scale grants. And a lot has happened, and I'll review some of the highlights of that with you today. Things have changed a lot in this four-year period. I think it's fair to say that as a research university, we had a head start against many other states by virtue of the resources that were granted us 4 years ago. But because of things that we'll talk about today, a lot has changed in terms of public pressure, public interest, interest from the private sector, to develop biofuels a lot faster than we may have imagined it happening just 4 years ago. And the paradox is that as visionary as you were and as we've tried to be with those resources, we now face the risk of falling behind. Efforts in states like California have really come on very strong in what they're intending to do with biofuels in their jurisdictions. A lot of interesting things have happened, and I'm very proud of what is developed within the University of Minnesota, for example, within the intellectual capital now here in the state of Minnesota. There will be, over this period of time, approximately 100 PhD and master's theses that will have been written on the research done under the auspices of this Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment. Those minds, the minds of our colleagues who are trained at the bachelor's level, will help be the workforce that really continues to lead us into a future of leadership. So with that introduction, I'll now move toward a presentation in three or four parts. I'll first talk about cellulosic ethanol because it's the buzzword. It sounds like the way we ought to go. I'll show you some evidence of ways that we could go as a state because of research done by our colleagues. But I'll also share with you the scientific challenges that make it a bit of a gap from here to there. So first of all, we sit, as you can see on this Department of Energy map of the biomass resources of the U.S., we in the heartlands are not only the heartlands in terms of the breadbasket for food, but the heartlands for the biomass that can be important in driving us into a future of renewable resources where biofuel is essentially the jet stream, if you will. The potential for cellulosic biofuels is really great. It is very varied. It varies here within a state like Minnesota from crop residues, forest residues, direct alternative energy crops that we might plant and harvest. It varies region by region within North America as well as around the world. It's really the only sustainable source of carbon-based liquid fuels and chemicals. Electricity can be generated from wind, but we simply cannot generate liquid fuels and chemicals readily from wind. As currently estimated by the Department of Energy, approximately 30% of our current fuel needs could be met if we could adequately harvest what could be the biomass potential of the United States. Biorefineries, the counterpart to oil refineries, could economically convert cellulose to ethanol. That will be the first stage. But there will be many other stages and outputs from this. And it will be not by simply using the same technologies we currently use to turn starch into ethanol, but by combining that with thermal and chemical conversion processes as well as the enzymatic conversion processes to date. But it's going to be critical to get this going by partnering both among universities and between units within universities, but also industry and government. So what I think we're beginning to see is that our energy future, although maybe perhaps more secure, looks much more complex. As you see on the left side of this diagram, our current picture is we use crude oil or we use coal. And those are the inputs, the feedstocks, if you will, and out of that we get electricity for transportation and the raw materials for chemicals and various materials. The biorefineries, though, actually have some really interesting advantages if we can get up to that over that threshold. The feedstocks will vary dramatically. That is, it will be much more diverse than simply corn as we're using today. As I said just a few moments ago, it'll capitalize on the kinds of crops that can be grown both on productive as well as marginal lands, both in our country and around the world. That around the world piece, because as fast as I think we're moving, there are economies and research enterprises moving very, very quickly in other parts of the world, India and China in particular. So our current practice using our existing corn wet and dry mills is to take corn, hydrolyze the starch with enzymes, and then ferment that sugar, dextrose or glucose, into the fuel and byproducts that we currently use. The next generation of to do that. And to that point that was asked of Commissioner Hugesson, the biorefinery will have at its heart the same sort of fermentation capacity, the same kinds of vats, distillation apparatuses that you see in current. But in addition, we'll begin to see the possibility of treating cellulose and lignocellulose, the cell walls of those plants and trees, and unleash the latent energy, the sugars that are tied up in those polymers, both pretreatment with physical mechanisms as well as enzymes. That will liberate then other sugars besides glucose and dextrose, the so-called C5 sugars, 5-carbon sugars, and other 6-carbon sugars that can then be harnessed to create fuels and products. In addition, the complete and integrated biorefinery will have, as I indicate down here at the bottom, the possibilities for thermochemical conversion or gasification. And out of that come yet new both products and kinds of fuels that look very interesting to be harvested. So I'd like to now quickly review some of the scientific challenges. Illustrated in this box is cellulose as those long beige tubes, and then wrapped around are hemicelluloses in blue and even more recalcitrant polymers, the lignans, that are really tough to break down. Interestingly, the only way we've been able to break down lignans has been to do so by heating them, essentially. Interestingly, we have some very interesting and, we think, breakthrough research happening under the auspices of IRIE at the University of Minnesota, where a couple of our people have, for the first time, identified enzymes that break down lignans. And if you think about it, there are entities that break down lignans out in nature. For example, trees that fall in the forest don't stay as trees, as hardwood trees. They rot. They rot due to the action of fungi. And if you think about insects, insects such as termites have harbored within their digestive system microbes that have enzymes that break down those lignans. And in turn, they can then utilize those lignans and the latent energy and nutrients within that. So using biological sources, there are ways to bust this stuff apart and to harness the energy. But we first need to better understand how the cell wall is made. I mean, it's frightening and shocking how little we know about the composition and structure of the cell wall of plants and trees. We need to know more about that. We need to design better enzymes from these natural sources and design them so they're efficient and the cost can make it price competitive with other approaches. We need to, as I said just a moment ago, break down or unlock these lignans. And we need to figure out how to both enhance the sugar content and minimize things that can contaminate the fermentation broth, toxic inhibitors. In order to do this, it takes a really comprehensive approach. It's not a couple of guys in their lab rolling up their sleeves and solving this in a week or so. Instead, it requires mobilization of people from across all kinds of disciplines, people who don't talk the same language, but together have the capacity to address these problems. And I've listed disciplines galore that are within the higher ed system here in Minnesota. There are challenges within the realm of feedstock. What are we going to use as cellulosic? Commissioner Hugesson referred to corn stover. That essentially is a no-brainer. We've got to start there. Other states in the West, for example, will be using wheat straw as the starting material. But what are we going to do that we can grow and grow productively and perhaps as an alternative crop to growing corn or growing wheat? How are we going to, as Commissioner Hugesson also alluded to, this biomass stuff is heavy to transport and bulky. How are we going to figure out how to densify it so it's more economical to transport that stuff, to improve the pretreatment locally, and to make it more, and to determine what is feasible for transporting this biomass relative to where it's going to be processed. And then what is, you know, kind of a vexing problem, it's both an opportunity and a problem, is, as you've been discussing, what the cost of the use of corn for ethanol is driving up the cost of food. So there's this impact as food and fiber intersect with each other. How are we going to navigate that space? And then finally, there are ecosystem services that we are losing as a consequence of our current practices of growing corn, growing soybeans. How might we, especially in sensitive watershed zones, if you will, turn around from those impacts and treat our ecosystems in a more healthy manner? And how might we harness marginal lands and get some twofers or threefers out of harvesting energy crops on marginal lands, perhaps restoring habitat for wildlife and so on? So converting the biomass is going to require more efforts, and there are challenges out there. These organisms and enzymes have to be engineered in order to break down multiple forms of biomass. If we're moving away from a single kind of biomass but to a diverse biomass feedstock, can we break it all down together? And at the same time, can we discover or can we engineer plants to make them more amenable to breakdown by enzymatic and thermochemical action? We need to then be able to merge all of this into an integrated biorefinery, so it's not several different shops, each doing one job, but integrated together, so that we really have, as indicated in this box, the integrated biorefinery that hums and works very, very efficiently. There are also challenges in what kind of fuels will come out. Not only will the feedstocks that we use be more diverse than we're currently thinking about, but the products coming out. Can we figure out discrete and niche markets for all of these possible products? The variety of products that can come out are really intriguing, but we haven't fully scoped out how they would be used and how we might adapt existing transportation engines, existing home heating, industrial heating, and so on, to take advantage of these new fuels. We need to figure out how current engines can handle these fuels, develop the next generation of engines, and improve the use of byproducts into usable substances. There are also economic challenges, and good people have to get around this and get their arms around this and figure out how you put this together and where the tipping points can occur that will whereby policies can be written that will help move this into the marketplace and do so in a sustainable sort of way. And as pointed out at the bottom, and as Commissioner Hugesson said, the current capital costs for cellulosic ethanol as we currently have it are prohibitively expensive, except on a kind of a pilot and demonstration scale. So I'd now like to just spend a couple of minutes talking about what I think are a couple of breakthroughs in some elements of the work that we've been doing, and I'm pleased that we have with us today two people, Regents Professor Dave Tillman, who's here, who can answer the questions that I cannot answer, and Bill Bergson from NRRI, who's also here, whose work we will also feature. Dave has been working at this site, which is about 35 miles northeast of here, northwest of here, at East Bethel, Minnesota, our Cedar Creek Natural History Area. And his work has been ongoing for now more than 20 years, where he's been looking at the value that diversity brings to the health of an ecosystem. And lo and behold, I don't think Dave, in setting out these plots on the Cedar Creek land 25 years ago, thought he was going to be working on issues as poignant as they are today in terms of biofuels. And here we are with being able to harvest, if you will, the fruits of his research. Our goal with the kind of research that he and our other team members are doing is to make biofuels a long-term solution for our energy and environmental needs without competing with food production or causing added ecosystem destruction. This first generation of biofuels has been amazing, I think, in terms of persuading the American public that you can grow something in our fields and within a few weeks to a few months, having a high-energy, high-quality transportation fuel. I mean, 10 years ago, who would have thunk it? It was simply hard to believe. And here we are all believing that today. So that's been a real breakthrough. What we've, this whole concept of from the field to the fuel tank is there. Producers are clearly interested in growing and harvesting energy crops, participating in the value chain there. In addition to just growing it, and manufacturers see markets for alternative fuel vehicles. But as Dave and his colleagues pointed out in a paper published early this summer, dedicating all, and I repeat, all of the U.S. corn and soybean crop to biofuels would meet only 12% of U.S. gasoline demand and 6% of diesel demand. Now, clearly there are issues on the demand side, and we've got to figure out as a country how to conserve, how to be more efficient in the use of these valuable resources. But as you can see, using these energy-rich food crops simply cannot solve our transportation fuel needs. But it's been amazingly effective as a demonstration. And it will, as Commissioner Hugesson said, I think we will forever be using corn and soybeans as niche solutions in our transportation fuel business. But we've got to work toward better biofuels, if you were. We've got to work toward biomass feedstock that's producible with low inputs, that is reducing the fuel used to plant, harvest, and nurture, the fertilizers and the pesticides. Secondly, we've got to figure out how to grow productive biomass on land with low agricultural value, marginal lands. And importantly, for considerations of global warming and climate change, we've got to figure out how to sequester carbon, how we can biologically sequester carbon in order to help avert the impending crisis that our children and our children's children are facing. So this is another view of Dave's experiments that, as again, some of these plots were established in 1994. And these are plots that have random compositions of native prairie species, in some cases a single species growing, in other cases 2, 4, 8, or 16 species, and then there are a number of plots with combinations of 32 species. And Dave has been assessing the behavior and performance of these miniaturized ecosystems now for this very long period of time. And among the, and I should say that Dave's work has led to amazing recognition in the scientific world. In the scientific world, Dave's published work, largely from Cedar Creek Natural History Area, is the most highly impacted work. His work has the highest impact of anyone in the entire world. That is, there are people who track scientific publications, how many times others cite them, and how those findings lead to other findings. And Dave leads the world in the bin called Ecology and Environmental Sciences, based on this work. This is a Minnesota home run. And what we're now finding is that not only has it found in very deep sense how ecosystems function and how diversity contributes to the health of ecosystems, but it spells out in dramatic terms to how biofuels ought to be produced. The major discovery is that diverse mixtures of perennial prairie grasses that is, may be a significant new source for biomass for producing carbon-negative biofuels. That is not carbon-neutral, but carbon-negative. Who would have thunk it that you can grow things, that you can restore prairies with perennial crops and sequester carbon that can otherwise not be captured? This is at least a threefer. So important other impacts. The yield of this kind of culture is more than two times the biomass that you get from monoculture. Even if you grow switchgrass, which is one of the crops included here, switchgrass in monoculture doesn't do nearly as well as switchgrass or any other combination of species in polyculture. So the whole notion of growing things together. And this is interesting because I can never imagine, having grown up in a small farming community north of Seattle many years ago, I can't imagine growing up in either that environment or this environment how we could ever do food-based agriculture using polyculture. Right? I mean, we're never going to be able to plant corn, soybeans, and tomatoes in the same plot, right, and harvest that stuff. The only thing I can imagine us harvesting is crops for energy. So this is an amazing finding, and it's right down the sweet spot of what we should be doing for biofuels. As I emphasized before, this is carbon-negative production of biofuels. Dave found that you can create more net energy with other positive variables on growing this on marginal soils than you can growing corn on fertile soil. A profound finding. It requires fewer inputs to grow and cultivate, therefore our ecosystems benefit, and all of this is more resilient to drought, disease, and it's applicable to fuels and power. And if you look at a schematic and you ask why, well, how could this be? If you look at underground in a prairie, and an undisturbed prairie, you see that the root structure here is very different than the root structure of the kind of corn and soybeans that we plant and harvest annually. And this is part of that magic in terms of sequestering and maintaining sequestered carbon. Now to turn very quickly to speak briefly about the forest. Because
I'm going to interrupt you for a minute.
Please.
Senator Chaudhry on this point?
Yes. Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, Dave could probably say this better than I can. So, Dave, why don't you come up here, actually, and Bill, too, because we'll probably need you for further questions.
Excuse me. So, Chairman, Senators, thank you. When plants are grown in the greatest soils, native plants basically restore that soil back to what it was before. If you look at all the carbon that you have, 40% of all the carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere.
Just, I hate to interrupt you, but I have to have you identify yourself.
I'm sorry. I'm David Tillman.
Welcome.
Okay. Oh, that is different. When fields are farmed, about half of the carbon in the soil, and soil carbon is the second largest storehouse of carbon on Earth. Ocean sediments are the most. The second largest is in soil. About half the carbon is released in the atmosphere because of decomposition of the soil. And when the soil is decomposed, it releases nutrients. It's a very natural part. When you farm a soil, you lose some of the carbon. If that soil is planted back with the native plants that created it in the first place, those plants end up storing carbon in the soil. And that store of carbon that can be added back to degraded agricultural soil, soils that were farmed and are abandoned, some of them are CRP, some are in other status right now, that carbon is removed from the atmosphere, goes into plants, the plants shed it in the soil as roots, and it builds up through time. And we get about, it's about 2 U.S. tons per acre of carbon dioxide that is removed from the atmosphere every year and stored in the soil as organic matter, and that builds up year after year after year at that rate. and it only takes about 0.2 tons per acre of fossil fuel carbon to plant the prairie, to harvest it, to bale it, to transport it to a processing plant and have it be converted into ethanol or other biofuels. And so the net effect is that by the time you're done burning that biofuel, that ethanol or whatever, you actually have less carbon dioxide in the air than you had before. The reason you do is that carbon is now bound up in organic matter that's slowly building up in the soil. It'll build up by our work. We've been following 2,200 plots since 1982 looking at this. There's about 100 to 150-year period during which this soil will, it'll take for the soil to be restored back to its pre-agricultural carbon levels. And during that period of time, there's almost a constant rate of accrual of carbon. And so there's a chance for a very long-term sequestration of atmospheric carbon dioxide by native prairie plants or by probably by native forest plants. We haven't done that work, but I'm sure the same is happening there, growing in those sites. That was more than 30 seconds. Sorry, Senator.
Perhaps I could add just one more word. It's important to remember at the beginning of this that photosynthesis is that process that all green plants undergo that captures carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, right? Captures carbon dioxide with water, produces oxygen, and the carbon that was in the carbon dioxide is then made into the plant material. Okay? So that's part of this whole cycle. Correct, Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry. We've been, by burning fossil fuels, either coal or crude oil, we're burning photosynthesis that occurred 200 million years. We're taking photosynthesis that occurred 200 million years ago and was buried by geologic time and geologic forces, and we're liberating that carbon, which was buried under the soil, and we're liberating it to the atmosphere. That's the chief cause as we know it. Point in time. So anything we can do to pull that carbon back out, rebury it, in this case using a biologic process, is averting this tragedy we feel we're facing.
And you burning the native grasses has less carbon emissions than the amount they store over time in the ground.
The idea of carbon-negative biofuels is difficult to explain, and I understand your confusion. When we discovered it, we didn't quite believe it because it really surprised us. In a given year, all of the above-ground biomass that you see, all the prairie hay fuel that's produced, is produced taking carbon dioxide out from the air, and that becomes the biomass of the hay. If you will, that you can mow then and make energy from. So you have carbon that was in the air. Carbon dioxide was in the air. It goes into hay. When you convert it into energy and burn it, it goes back in the atmosphere. That has no net effect. It was taken out and released 1 year and so on back and forth. What has a net effect that causes these to be carbon negative is that there is some of that carbon that is taken out of the air, some of that carbon dioxide that ends up being put into the roots and very slowly decomposes in the soil. And it's that input of that carbon into the soil that is much greater than all the fossil fuel carbon that you release in farming that causes these fuels to be carbon negative.
Chair, doesn't that make sense? Because aren't you mowing the grass so you're never getting rid of the roots?
Right, yes.
The ground, like you're getting rid of the coal out of the ground. So that's always, as it's left to grow constantly, it's constantly collecting
if I may, Mr. Chair and Senator, the one thing I forgot to tell you, that prairie plants are very long-lived plants. These are long-lived perennials. They're plants that live 50, 100 or more years. And if once you plant a native prairie, there are prairies in Minnesota, but the ones I know about from the scientific literature in Kansas that have been harvested for prairie hay sustainably for over 140 years. There's 65 years of data I can show you where there's just levels, yields are basically just flat. You can harvest it year after year after year, have a sustainable source of energy at the same time that prairie is building up carbon in its soil.
Go on.
Thank you. So to return now and briefly talk about forest. We're blessed in Minnesota to have the Natural Resources Research Institute up in Duluth, this has turned out to also be an amazing center of excellence. We talk about the major energy crops that you hear about in the popular press for cellulosic biofuels. This is rapidly becoming cost competitive. To think about using cellulose as the starting material. And just been talking about the points that are raised here. What I'd like to focus on now is that there are not a lot of places in the country that have focused on genetic improvement and management practices for grasses and for hybrid pop. Fortunately, NRRI up at Duluth is one of two places in the country that is renowned for its work in creating new strains of hybrid poplar. We're fortunate to have them here, and also in this whole mix about how do we move forward and look at the second and third generation of biofuels. This is one of the largest improvement programs in the country for poplar. They've been going for a decade on this thing. They collaborate both with the private sector and with the USDA Forest Service at Rhinelander. They've produced a phenomenal number of new strains to test for their viability in this industry, testing for a number of years. And the goal is to increase the genetic diversity, the yield, and disease resistance of these hybrid poplar so that forests and marginal lands upon which hybrid poplar can grow can be used as the resource base for growing these kind of products. There are continued research needs to keep this going. Those are indicated here. You can read through them faster than I can read them to you. But this is another jewel in the crown of Minnesota's strategy for moving forward on second, third generation biofuels. And now I'd like to close with just a few words about this opportunity that we are staring down with respect to the Department of Energy. The U.S. Department of Energy has led energy policy and research through its national labs in particular. Minnesota is unfortunately a state that does not have a national laboratory like Argonne National Lab in Illinois, the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado, and so on and so on. The national labs now have a program that is out for competition, and our sleeves are rolled up, and we're in the thick of that whole process. The project that they have undertaken and put a lot of resources behind is called the DOE Genomics Genomes to Life Program. They issued a request for proposals back in July. They are requesting and intend to create two centers, bioenergy research centers, in the United States. The due date for these applications is February 1st. That's only 14 days from now, if I count correctly, and we have a team of more than 100 people within the University of Minnesota, MinSCU, OWRI, and our partners working like crazy to put a competitive proposal in front of the DOE. The stakes are high. These centers will be funded to the tune of $125 million each, $125 million over 5 years to each of these centers. The University of Minnesota has never submitted a grant for this amount of money. This is the largest grant we've ever submitted. This has brought the attention of every research university in the country, research universities that have had nothing to do with biofuels, that are far from the heartlands where any biomass might be grown, are rolling up their sleeves and competing with us. The focus, the Department of Energy believes that we need to take a deeper approach than has been launched thus far, using what is this new discipline in biology called systems biology, focusing on plants and microbes. These centers will, and I quote, develop novel biological solutions for the production of such fuels as cellulosic ethanol or hydrogen, or for other groundbreaking bioenergy research with the potential to revolutionize biology-based energy production. Also, to understand the industrial-level roadblocks and bottlenecks for cost-effective production of fuels from biomass. This is a very deep and comprehensive program. We have an advantage. We're in the heartlands, as we all know, and we've talked about, and have a running start with the Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment at our backs. We're a world-class comprehensive research university. Both we and our colleagues in MinSCU have a history of bioenergy research that extends back before our Initiative funding, our heritage of ethanol production facilities, farmer-owned co-ops, and eager group of producers. We have an interesting complexion of both agriculture and forest resources for as a test bed for this kind of new technology. We're an innovative people. We have a lot of industries and are known for the innovation in industrial sectors here. We're certainly a national leader in renewable energy policy incentives. A lot of things will be happening here in the legislature this session that will be pushing that agenda. But we have to complement that with a research agenda for reasons I'll share with you in just a moment. Our proposed areas of focus, just so you know about them, we have a group of focused research groups in plant genomics, breeding, and plant and production. There are 19 groups of people rolling up their sleeves in this area. There also another one of these focused research groups in metabolic engineering and enzyme mechanisms, another groups 20 through 38. So-called cross-cutting research groups. We have 51 research groups that are put together amazing ideas. Whether we win or lose in this competition for these two centers, we've put together some amazing dream teams that we will shop those proposals wherever we can to get them funded. And these are faculty and staff and students from the University of Minnesota system-wide, all of our campuses, from MinSCU, many of their campuses, Carleton College among the privates is very eager in doing things, and collaborators from 8 other universities across the country. But we're in the driver's seat on this. We also have an education and training component, which will focus on the establishment of undergraduate, graduate, and postdoctoral training programs, so we have the workforce to deliver on this front. You see the list of our collaborating institutions from MinSCU, the privates, Carleton is there again, University of Minnesota, and we're very pleased with a newly and rapidly emerging collaboration with our colleagues at the White Earth Reservation and the White Earth Tribal College. There's also a really interesting and expanded cooperation with growers, with industry, and other statewide organizations. Another piece in this puzzle of preeminence in our energy research is we're bursting at the seams at the University of Minnesota for our capacity and our ability to bring teams from across these diverse disciplines together in an elbow-to-elbow fashion. So we're in the early stages of planning a new facility that we're calling the National Center for Biofuels Research. A building that would be located, if it were constructed, on the St. Paul campus near the Cargill Building for Microbial and Plant Genomics. This stuff is turning out to be big business. States are vying for leadership in this emerging biofuels industry. Universities are coming ways I could have never imagined, launching research efforts. This is truly becoming something of a Sputnik-like or a space shot, a moonshot kind of effort. With the kind of resources that are being mustered. And state governments and companies, the private sector, are coming together. I should say that people like the investment banking firm here in town, Piper Jaffray, their fastest growing business sector is biofuels. Okay? So it's not just academics, it's not just government subsidy stuff, it's the private sector moving like crazy. But the competition is accelerating, and I'll illustrate here just what some other states are doing. Almost all states are generating some kind of a strategy for taking a leadership role. Michigan, a $1 billion plan for alternative energy so that the auto industry is not left in the dust in this thing. Iowa has the first commercial-scale ethanol plant under design and construction. Illinois, research facility at Southern Illinois University. Chevron invested $12 million at Georgia Tech. State of Oregon, $30 million green energy initiative. California, governor proposed $30 million for alternative energy research. Chevron put $25 million in at UC Davis. There was a ballot initiative in California that was rejected by a small margin that would have put $1.2 billion into the research universities of California to create biofuels over the next decade. That failed by a small margin, largely attributed to the incredible lobbying efforts by Big Oil to British BP, the company former known as British Petroleum, announced back in the summer its intention to fund a single university to the tune of $500 million. Bioenergy Research Center. The rumor is that Berkeley, with UC Davis and maybe Iowa State or MIT or Cambridge University in the UK are in the running. We could not get their attention. We could not get their attention in spite of letters from our governor and President Brunix to the CEO of, and then finally, these DOE energy centers that we talked about. Now, it's not just U.S.-based competition. As I alluded to before, it's the rest of the world. China has built the largest ethanol facility in the world, 200-million-gallon facility, and they are on fire in terms of a renewable energy biofuel agenda. So I close with some key messages. And the first one, to take advantage of what of the investments that have been made to date and strengthen Minnesota's leadership position and create economic opportunities. And I'd like to offer a brief metaphor. If you think about the healthcare industry and the role that medical devices plays in that, every hospital in the United States, hospitals in most of the developed world, have physicians and surgical suites where teams of surgeons and technicians implant pacemakers. We do that here in Minnesota. Those pacemakers are, and the implantation of that kind of technology, of course, has benefit to the patient receiving it, and it has benefit, economic benefit, to those communities, hospitals, and the employees of those hospitals. Minnesota gets a double benefit because those pacemakers are made and manufactured and invented in Minnesota at places like Medtronic and Boston Scientific. We need to have a leadership position because we don't want to end up like the hospitals in Alabama and other places that are simply implanting the pacemakers. We don't want to be using someone else's technology to make our biofuels. We want to both make them, and we want to be the inventors and the producers of the technology and the manufacturers of that technology so we continue to be in that value stream. This is an opportunity that we have, and we can't turn away from it. We need to educate the next generation of renewable energy innovators and workforce, and I think we're working very closely together between the university, Minsky, Owry, private college sector, and I think we have a great head start. We can assist the state in moving toward the goals that are being outlined today and by the governor. We can better position the university and the state to compete for federal research funds, which will power this effort down the road. And finally, improve Minnesota's environment by developing a more sustainable energy system. So with that, I thank you greatly for your attention and would be happy to entertain questions if time permits.
Doctor, I have a question. How can we speed this process along? Land where I farm is $5,000 an acre. They're not going to raise grass on that unless they can get some decent return on the money. They'll still be corn, but we're down the road a ways, aren't we, before we get to where we hopefully we're going to get to? How can we get there quicker, help you get that, go out to Washington and put a little pressure on our powers to be? We need more funds.
Well, Senator Vickerman, thank you. Yes, we do, and pressure on the powers that be. I mean, we're also in a very interesting situation with leadership at the national level in the House Ag Committee. Congressman Colin Peterson, the House Transportation Committee with Congressman Oberstar. I think there is something of a perfect storm. It's interesting because on the day that Dave Tillman's paper was published in Science Magazine as the cover story, the Star Tribune ran a piece, and our friends and colleagues, the corn growers and so on, made comments that this sounds very interesting, but we can't imagine putting our land into fallow for a couple of years while growing diverse prairie species because we're going to lose two or three seasons of valuable corn to harvest. So where are we going to scale this stuff up? I mean, Dave's plots are little plots. And that very same day, we had very interesting conversations that were continuing with our friends who said, marginal lands, that's us. And those are our folks on the reservations. It could be a very interesting strategy to take lands such as those and lands elsewhere that are marginal by definition and marginal in productivity and scale up a very large-scale experiment to production, you know, and really do it at the test, at the commercialization level, pilot to commercialization. And, yes, that will take resources of a variety of sources. You know, it's going to take state, local reallocation within our education systems and help from federal and private sources. We have a really great opportunity.
Just remember this. I was here when we put the ethanol bill together, when the author to that bill. And the story was, oh, that'll never work. We're the leader in that. We're also the leader in biodiesel. And we can be the leader in this if we get going. Because there's places up north, and I travel up there quite a bit. We get 200 bushels of corn. I don't think to get 40. They'd be better off to have switchgrass or something in certain parts of the state. It's all one state, but it would work for them. So we need to continue with that. Any other questions?
Senator? Thank you. Thank you, Senator. And thank you for the presentation. This is just such exciting news. I'm a big fan of wanting to invest in some of the new emerging technologies, and certainly biofuels and the research that you've been doing is right there. And a very tiny small part, I can relate to what you're talking about. I'm the University of Minnesota Extension Service Master Gardener, and we've been talking about sustainable some planting with prairie grasses for quite a long time, and I've seen the charts, you know, many years ago having to do with gigantic prairie root systems that are available to us. And the University of Minnesota Extension Services through the Master Gardeners have been encouraging homeowners to be planting with native grasses and prairies for quite a long time. So this is just very exciting to me to hear some of the same information that we've been talking about now in terms of biofuel. I'm wondering if we have heard, you were talking about Dave Tillman and, you know, how well-researched and well-quoted he is globally. I wonder if you know about the little jewel in the Winona area, where it's my hometown, Prairie Way Nursery. They've been studying and researching funerals down there for a long time. And the owner, Alan Wayne, probably would talk plant genomics and monoculture versus biodiversity for hours with me. And I just want to say this has been a real inspiring presentation. And I'm all for it, Senator Fickerman, just putting some muscle behind this and trying to get this off the ground.
I'll put in a little plug for the university. We have the smartest people in the world right in this state. I mean it. We go outside to get people in here, but we have got such a vast knowledge in this state. It's unbelievable. But I'll even go down to my grandkids. They know how to run my cell phone. I don't know how to run that dumb thing. They can do all that, so we can really do it. Are there any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, members, I just wanted to comment that the University of Minnesota, and all of us are in a unique position because we're not Iowa State or the University of Iowa. We're not Michigan State or the University of Michigan. We have it all in one place. We have everything from an experiment station, extension, law school, medical school, College of Biological Sciences. So we're in a unique position to move this forward. And I think unless we dedicate some research to finding out whether upscaling this is really going to take us places, we're going to be lost because others will be running with it. We don't want to be like when the World Wide Web came about, we had the gopher, and that never succeeded. Everybody else, we come up with the idea and somebody takes it away from us. So we have to really pursue this in a major way.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, I don't know if who might want to answer this. I may be putting the cart way out ahead. You may have touched on it. When I go back, I've got a lot of marginal farmland in my district. How long does it take to establish a good stand of prairie grasses, and how long can we expect to harvest that before we have to rotate through something else?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scogin, I'd like to defer to our colleague Dave Tillman, the expert here, but I'd also like to say that we're also eager, and Dave will say more about this, I'm just prompting him to do that, that it's probably not just prairie grasses, but we're very interested in extending this into marginal lands that could grow shrubby, woody biomass, and a variety of other systems. So it's not just classic kind of prairie lands that have this possibility. We'd like to explore that across those kind of biomes that Minnesota enjoys.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the path from what is growing on some marginal land that is no longer being cultivated to a prairie
is probably about a five-year process, 3 to 5 years. But during that period of time, if there, it's possible to mow that land for hay and to harvest that hay, if you will, and use that hay. Actually, not quite hay. Hay you harvest when it has optimal nutritive value. You actually preferentially harvest biomass for energy when there's maximal energy and the lowest nutrient content, so you don't need to add nutrients back to your soil every year to make up for it. But it's possible to seed prairie species on top of land that has very few or none of them in it, that's more of just sort of a wild grassland-like site that hasn't been farmed for a while. And they're very good competitors. And the places around the state that I've seen this done on their own in almost all sites, they can grow, and within 3 to 5 years we'll take it over and we'll turn that site into prairie. If there were a market for this biomass at the beginning, you could be harvesting whatever whatever plants were growing there at the start, and that would be turned over toward much more productive, high-diversity prairie as these things you seeded in grew. As far as how long you can do it, as I said, there are some counties in Kansas for which hay production is the major cash crop. They have it's called Woodson County is the main one. It's called they call themselves the hay capital of the world, and they harvest native prairie hay that has never been broken. They don't fertilize it, they don't irrigate it, they just mow it for hay. And it turns out it's almost as profitable as many other kinds of farming because there's almost no capital cost to do this and very little input cost. I think that if we go to lands that are, let's say, currently enrolled in CRP and other lands that have been abandoned from agriculture, in areas that were part of the prairie habitat before settlement in Minnesota, we know prairie grows there very well. High-diversity prairie can be very productive there. It takes about 5 years before you hit the high productivity, before these plants take over. And actually, in our work, we were more productive after 10 years than we were after five, especially because the legumes that are growing there are able to put nitrogen back in the soil and make those soils more and more productive through time. That was almost a lecture, I'm sorry.
In Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you have to start with controlled burns and stuff like that to get strong stands, or would these grasses not need the controlled burn start?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the process of restoring prairie right now, I will say, is more of an art than a science. And there are many, not many, but there are several people in the state who commercially restore prairie, and they all have their own ways of doing it. I know what we have done to establish different compositions of prairie species in our research site, and burning and mowing early on in the process can probably speed it up by a year or two. But ultimately, the reality is these prairie plants they're native to here. They're very good at living in these soils and these climates, and they basically beat out competitively almost everything else that is with them. And so if the seed are put there, and if there's a dense thatch layer, you have to burn it to get rid of it. You have to have the seeds be able to get to the soil. So if there is thatch buildup, yes, you'll have to burn it and or mow it to get going, or plow it if you wanted to. So it depends on the site. And it is an area that we would need the help from extension agents who get to be knowledgeable about this aspect to communicate this with farmers who want to try it. But I do think our best hope, frankly, is having CRP and rim lands and so on be made available for harvesting biomass for energy. If that happens, then as the markets develop in the next few years, farmers will be, and as there's more research results, farmers will be able to find out how much more yield they might be able to get on their land if instead of having whatever was growing wild, they had a higher proportion of native prairie plants, including both the grasses and the legumes. And then I think people can make the right economic decision for their productivity on their own land. And when they plant, the big cost is buying the seed the first time. Once these things become established, these plants literally live forever unless you plow them under.
Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you harvest the seed before you use it for a biomass burn, or can't you harvest it first?
Yes, yes, you may. You can actually harvest the biomass, thrash the seed from it, and then take the biomass and use that for bioenergy. And that might be a very important process during the early stages of this, because right now planting prairie, which I think is a wonderful thing to do, is done more out of love of nature, and which means it isn't as big an industry as planting agricultural land, which is a vast majority of the state. There aren't sufficient seed sources right now to have a large number of farmers do this. if this really becomes a major demand, it will take some creativity to be able to supply the seeds. And one of the creativity is that once a prairie has been restored, within about 5 years, you can be annually harvesting seed from that at the same time that you harvest the biomass for energy.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are some of the grasses that hold the greatest promise?
In Minnesota, the major grasses are big bluestem, switchgrass, little bluestem, and Indian grass. And then the legumes that are best are lupin, purple prairie clover, bush clover, and a native vetch. Those are the ones that we've seen that, in combination, give us these very high yields.
Here, here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I've planted two switchgrass fields in my life. One was about 60 acres, and the other one was about 40 acres. And the 60-acre field was planted during the drought of 1988, which was tough going. And it took a long time for that switchgrass to really get to the point where it looked like a decent prairie grass field, because it just had that drought problem the first year. But the other field was planted earlier in the 80s when under wetter conditions, and it seemed like it took off fairly fast. Now, one of the recommendations in those days was to spray atrazine for 2 years in a row to try to control weeds to help the switchgrass get going. It's in the same family as corn, so atrazine doesn't adversely affect the switchgrass. But the one problem I consistently had in both fields was a thistle problem. And since the advent of Roundup-ready crops, what I would do if I was going to do it again is I'd make sure I had Roundup on that field for 2 years in a row, at least. Probably 2 years is enough to get rid of the thistle, get the whole thing cleaned up, and then go into it with a switchgrass plantation or maybe a more diverse prairie grass plantation. And if we're looking at CRP fields that have been out of production for a long time and there is a quack grass or a thistle problem out there, it seems to me the best thing to do is to put Roundup Ready corn and beans for at least a Roundup Ready crop on the field 2 years in a row to get rid of those weeds before you attempt the prairie grass plantation.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think that for any given site, there are many different ways of preparing the land. It's interesting when we look at this, even thistles are outcompeted by these very high diversity mixtures of native prairie species. What happens with these high diversity mixtures is there are plants with shallow roots, plants with deep roots, plants that grow well in the spring, some that grow well when it's hot, and they leave so little soil nitrate, which is a main living resource in our site, left over, that is very hard for these exotic plants, which tend to have much higher nutrient requirements, to actually coexist with them. A single species like switchgrass is very good at drawing down nutrients where its roots are in the soil at the time of year, the warm part of the year when switchgrass grows. But if you have switchgrass mixed with other grasses, mixed with other flowering plants, if you will, the prairie flowers, that grow at different times of the year and with different rooting patterns, they, as a whole high-diversity ecosystem, are very good at squeezing out even things like thistle. So I think pretreatment could be wise. It can definitely give you prairie much more quickly. You can save a couple years if you treat it right in the first few years and how long it takes to develop.
Okay, one more question, then we need to move on. Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I've been working on an editorial on self-cellulosic research. I'm glad I read it. Confirms a lot of what I've been thinking, particularly with regards to the producer payments. It seems like the challenge is the how do we get farmer buy-in between that 2 to 5 year gap, and that producer payments can certainly help that along. So I think this has been a wonderful discussion.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Now we're going to move into Teresa Spaeth. If she'll come up, all these people are members of the AURI. Teresa is the executive director. Rose Patzer is associate scientist. Dr. Wien is a scientist. Alan Doring is also a scientist. They're all members of the AURI. So welcome to the committee, and let's hear from you.
Thank you, Chairman Vickerman and Senators. I am Teresa Spaeth, Executive Director of the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute, many of you also know it as ARI, or A-U-R-I, and I'm pleased to be here with you today. You've heard a lot of information on the history of biofuels in Minnesota, and you've seen a glimpse of the opportunities available for the future. What we're here to talk with you about today is what's actually happening out there on the countryside. As many of you are aware, AURI has facilities in rural locations, and we have a facility in Crookston, Marshall, and more, and Waseca. We're here to bring with you today information on the biofuels industry, specifically in biodiesel, co-product utilization, and ethanol. I have with me here today, they'd like to introduce to you Rose Patzer with our Marshall office. She specializes in biodiesel, especially in quality issues.
That's not what's good.
Excuse me. Also with us today is Ed Wien. He's with our fermentation laboratory in the Crookston, Minnesota. And we also have with us today Al Deering. He is a co-product utilization scientist in our Waseca laboratory. And with that, Rose, I will turn it over.
Welcome to the committee. I need your names for the. I named your names for the record when you get ready.
Yes, thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. I am Rose Patzer, associate scientist with AURI, and as Ms. Spaeth introduced me, I do work heavily with biodiesel. Have worked with it since about 1996, for the most part during that time. I will share with you some of the information regarding ethanol and biodiesel. Some of it we've already heard from Commissioner Hugesson and Dean Eldy. And then we'll talk a little bit more about the biomass activities. And what we intend to do is introduce you to some of the activities that you may not be aware of that are going on currently in our state, especially with emphasis regard to biodiesel. First, I'd like to chat with you about the liquid biofuels themselves. As we all recognize, every one of us in this room recognize that ethanol is a prime example. I put 6,200. I didn't change that appropriately. There are 16 plants with 620 million gallons of ethanol production per year in Minnesota, with multiple new plants in development. Your handouts, senators of the committee, will show 550 million gallons, and that's our old number. I talked to Ralph Groshen, and we got some updated, and I apologize for making that change. Just did it just a moment ago, actually, to 620, and I put 6,200, so I beg your pardon there. We also recognize biodiesel as certainly a liquid biofuels. There are four operational plants in Minnesota with approximately 63 million gallons, as Commissioner Hugesson stated earlier. And we also recognize the evaluation of addition of refined sugar to ethanol processing, hopefully with the intention to speed up that fermentation process. And very importantly, with regard to the biofuels, renewable energy across the board, is that we pay attention to co-product utilization. First, I'd like to share with you some of the ethanol stats in the, there's a 6,200 again in Minnesota, but in nationwide industry, we have 100 plants producing about 5.3 billion gallons of ethanol a year. That's a pretty phenomenal number. There are 61 new plants under construction or plans to expand. That additional production will bring us up to 6 billion additional gallons of ethanol per year. This, if we stay on track with that, it's going to surpass the renewable fuel standard requirement of 7.5 billion gallons by 2012. We're going to surpass that way before that date, so that's very impressive. In Minnesota, as I stated, and you're very familiar, the 16 operating plants, three plants under construction, and we have a strong drive to bring home E20 available at the fuels by the year 2013. When we talk about ethanol, we should not forget to mention that the efforts aren't inclusive to Minnesota, but there is the Governor's Ethanol Coalition that was established in 1992. As we were all aware, Tim Pawlenty, Governor Pawlenty, chaired that coalition in 2005. They do have four objectives or goals that are embraced as well by the Minnesota Coalition for Ethanol, and those goals include increasing the use of ethanol usage and thereby decreasing the nation's dependence, and we've all heard that, reducing the dependence on foreign oil. Hopefully, then, we'll have an improved environmental activities, and also with renewable fuels, especially with regard to ethanol, we will see a stimulation in the national economy. When we talk about or discuss renewable fuels, we should really also not forget to talk about the co-products that are produced alongside with the renewable fuels, such as ethanol. Ethanol, there are two major co-products out of production: distillers dry grains, known as DDGs, and solubles or syrups. The DDGs themselves are primarily used as a feed ingredient in the livestock feed industry. But we also realize that DDGs have a high energy value, around 8,200 BTUs per pound. And that is one of the higher ones for the biomass material, the energy factors there. We have tested the DDGs for combustion, as a combustion fuel in industry, and we also recognize it as a component in for pelleted fuels. But it's very important to realize that in pelleted fuels, the DDGs can only be a component because, quite honestly, the DDGs themselves they make a poor pellet, very poor quality, very soft, very, you know, crumbly pellet, and therefore they won't. DDGs alone in a pellet form won't hold up to transportation or handling. So we bind them or make pellets with other biomass materials that will make a stronger pellet and very good for shipping and transportation. DDGs are also utilized by ethanol plants and gasification units to produce energy, and Dr. Wien's going to talk a little bit more about that. The solubles and syrups, the other co-product or major co-product of ethanol processing, are generally or most commonly sprayed back on the DDGs, and the DDGs are dried. And that really reduces disposal issue that could arise if we didn't do something with these syrups or the solubles. The syrup is also being used in fluidized bed systems to create power for ethanol plants, and that's very impressive. And also some research is going on with regard to utilizing them in an anaerobic digester. And we also have a preliminary study that was conducted to use and apply the solubles or the syrup on a field as a fertilizer. So very promising activity going on with the co-products in the ethanol industry. Next, I'd like to talk to you about the biodiesel industry, and let's recognize it as a transitioning nationwide industry. Just in 1999 alone, there's 500,000 gallons produced in our nation. We fast forward now to 2006, and we're looking at 200-plus million gallons produced of biodiesel in the United States. That's a very big leap. The projection for the industry is about 2.5 billion a gallon per year production in our country by the year 2009. We talked about the national level. If we look at the Minnesota level, we recognize four operational plants at about 63 million gallons a year capacity, 60 million of which are soy. 3 million, as Gene Hugeson mentioned, that multiple feedstocks such as yellow grease or animal fats. There are four plants under construction or planned, and they're introducing approximately 95 million gallons potential production, additional production of biodiesel right here in Minnesota, where 30 to 64 of them will utilize soy or declared soy. 30 million gallons are going to introduce canola, which is very exciting, and then 1.5 million gallons will introduce a different animal fat than we've seen before. When we talk about biodiesel activities in Minnesota, we need to recognize that Minnesota has a collective effort, just like the ethanol group with the coalition. We have the Minnesota Biodiesel Council that's assembled with all of our production plants and some of the vested interests in our state, as well as the governor's appointed Minnesota Biodiesel Task Force. I'd like to share with you some of the activities that are ongoing, very current within our state. Number one on the list to me is the quality assurance. Fantastic pat on the back for Minnesota is that all three of our major plants are BQ9000 certified, which is an ISO program to assure quality and assure that the fuel that's produced here in Minnesota meets our specifications or the ASTM specifications. As Commissioner Hugesson mentioned earlier, the hiccups that hit our state last year with regard to biodiesel, they don't necessarily go away, or at least they're not going to go away until they're unresolved. There is continued nationwide research on filter plugging issues. It's beyond our borders. It certainly was last year. We just happened to take the hit, I believe, because of our mandate. Maybe all eyes were on Minnesota. However, nationwide as well as right here within our state, to come to resolving some of the issues that have surfaced with regard to that fuel or fuel blends. The next series of topics I'd like to share with you regard the activities or public domain studies that are going on with biodiesel, and it may introduce you to some of the activities that are going on beyond using biodiesel in a typical motor vehicle. One of the first studies I'd like to share with you is the feasibility of biodiesel used in the Upper Mississippi River towboats. Here we have successfully completed phase one. We're looking to a phase two and phase three, a future three-year demonstration of using biodiesel at B20, 20% biodiesel up to B100 in a high or a large horsepower, slow RPM engines, and especially in the marine environment. We have an opportunity to study the use and utilize some of that fuel. I think from Minneapolis to St. Louis, the annual consumption of diesel is about 34 million gallons. So to tap into some of that, especially in the marine environment, I think this is a very big opportunity. Additional biodiesel activities include a batch production template. And as I think Commissioner Hugesson was asked regarding about the backyard producers or the on-farm producers, there's many of them around. And they are a concern because whether or not they can understand the production, the chemistry behind the reaction, the quality issues that are at stake, the fact that if I put a little gallon of fuel in my tank, I'm paying taxes, is a biodiesel producer on the farm going to? All of those issues have to be addressed. And we can't address them on a one-on-one basis. So what we are working to do is work with small processors and develop a template that they may be able to follow that will address production quality issues at surface, the chemical reactions, and then regulatory compliance as well, because that's very important with this. Another activity with biodiesel is an ATV, all-terrain vehicle. One of the first demonstrations of its kind, it was a collaboration with Articat, and a B20, a 20% biodiesel blend demonstration in a small engine was very successful in the demonstration. So we'll look forward to seeing these ATVs sporting some biodiesel fuel qualities as well. Continuing on with the biodiesel activities, biodiesel wind generation, you know, it's just phenomenal how often the renewable fuels can intermingle or cross paths. And here we're looking at wind generation. We have biodiesel backup in a diesel generator and a study that's going on with that. And the purpose is to use it as a backup source at the peaking times for energy requirements. We also have a huge study that will be coming out or released very shortly with regard to the prospects of expansion for soy-based biodiesel industry in Minnesota. That study does focus strongly on the opportunities and challenges, as many of our groups have discussed with you. If we can't do it all on soy, ethanol can't do it all on corn. So we need to recognize that those opportunities are there, but there's many challenges that come with them as well. As I stated earlier, the renewable fuels production, I believe, always comes with a co-product or a byproduct of the reaction, and the biggest one of biodiesel is glycerin. And recognize it as crude glycerin. It really is not the true or the purified glycerin in the form, and very few biodiesel plants are set up to purify the glycerin because of the cost. In its purest form, it's a widely used compound, over 1,500 known uses. But that's in its purest form. When we look at it, at the purity off of a biodiesel process, we're looking between 75 and 85% pure, and depending on the consistency and the plant's production capabilities. But there are opportunities with that crude glycerin. Certainly, I would suggest about 5 to 7 years ago, the crude glycerin could yield a producer about 33 to 70 cents a pound. That would be a production credit virtually. In today's market, it's very saturated. Because of that growth spurt I shared with you about biodiesel, we're looking between 0 and 5 cents a pound for that crude glycerin. So it becomes almost a disposal issue, or what else can we do with this material? So very strong focus on finding new or alternative uses for the crude glycerin off of our biodiesel production. One of them is to look at it as a fuel. It does have an energy value, I would say, ranging between 62 and 6,600 BTUs per pound. And pure glycerin, for instance, will have about 8,900 BTUs per pound. But so there are some opportunities that lie with glycerin. However, incomplete combustion of this material will yield some toxins, and that is a very big concern. We do have an emissions demonstration that will be conducted utilizing the crude glycerin as a combustion source in an industrial fuel. And, you know, besides energy, we also are looking at some feeding trails. I think you'll see or hear more of them that will be coming in print. Collaborative effort going on, headed by Sally Knoll at the University of Minnesota. She's going to look at a full-fledged feeding trial of the turkey productions. And at 3 to 4%, if that's anticipated inclusion rate in the feeding trials, we'll be able to utilize all of the crude glycerin that's produced right here in the state. With that, I would like to hand over the microphone to my colleague, Dr. Edward Wayne.
Welcome to the committee.
Chairman Beckerman, members of the committee. My name is Edward Wayne. I'm a microbiologist at the Crookston ARI facility. I'll be talking today about biomass energy opportunities, some of the bottlenecks, and where we see the future. I'll begin with cellulosic ethanol. It's been mentioned already several times today. Basically, the process is harvesting, collecting the biomass. It's pretreated with either heat and or oftentimes acid. It could be steam pressurization. Then it needs to be broken down with enzymes. This is one of the bottlenecks. Cellulosic ethanol. The enzymes are expensive at the moment. They're not as efficient as they could be at the moment. They're not suited for a wide range of cellulosic materials. So work is ongoing. It needs to continue in order to improve the process. One other bottleneck in this is the fermentation process itself. Different organisms are needed than we use in a typical ethanol plant. Therefore, the concentrations of ethanol, these different sugars, don't reach as high as a level as we do in a, you know, or a starch ethanol plant. Right now, we get about 15% corn dry mill ethanol plant, and that leads to a more efficient distillation process with 15%. If you're down at 7%, you're going to be boiling off twice as much water to get to that ethanol, so your energy costs will rise. One reason we've been talking about cellulosic ethanol, and one of the advantages, is we expect these plants to be energy self-sufficient. That is, they will burn the lignin and the invested cellulose in a power plant and exporters of energy. So the synergy with a starch ethanol plant is a real possibility. Starch ethanol plant is a large consumer of energy, and if you have excess energy on the cellulosic side, there could be a natural fit with those two systems. However, we're a long way there. One of the other bottlenecks, for example, a 50-million-gallon ethanol plant at current levels of technology will need somewhere between 500 and 700,000 tons of biomass. Use that ethanol. At 4 tons per acre, which is a dedicated energy crop, that's a pretty good yield in Minnesota. That'd take somewhere between 125 and 175,000 acres to produce that. That could be corn stover too. Took 4 tons off. Only took 2 tons off. I'm not sure where the recommendations down the road will be about how much corn stover we can remove on continuous basis. That could double those acres. So you'd be talking, you know, at 2 tons an acre, you're in that 400,000 to 500,000 acres for a 50 million gallon ethanol plant. Some of those figures need to be looked at when we talk more about cellulosic ethanol. Another method to create energy from biomass is gasification. Gasification create a synthetic gas after the biomass is heated under controlled conditions, very high temperatures. And the main products are carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, traces of methane, and hydrogen. Now, this carbon monoxide, which is the main fuel, can be reburned again to form heat, or it could be used to produce electricity. As you're transforming these sources of energy, there's always a loss of efficiency. So the most efficient use for synthetic gas is probably for direct heat. It's not always a desired energy source for every application. That's the most efficient process. Now, there's also some exciting work going on looking at using this carbon monoxide to feed organisms that produce ethanol. It's a fermentation by an anaerobic microorganism that produces ethanol. This carbon monoxide can also be passed over a catalyst to produce other liquid fuels such as ethanol, methanol, some either higher alcohols than that. Gasification is an energy-intensive process. Up till now, it's only been used when we had very cheap sources of energy. Gasification was used to make methanol at one time from natural gas, but as the price rose of natural gas rose, it became less economically efficient to produce it that way. So that production has ceased, at least in the United States. So the issues with gasification are you don't have a cheap source of biomass. The economics of the gasification process are called into question. So that's probably why we don't see a lot of gas fires at this point is due to the unknown costs of some of the raw materials. But further down the road, as energy prices, we presume they're going to increase, gasification probably has a lot more possibilities. Pyrolysis has been mentioned as a way that we could densify biomass at smaller sites in the field and then transport it to a larger facility. Pyrolysis can produce bio oils. They can be burned directly, or they can be used, processed further into some more higher value chemicals. But pyrolysis is also a possibility. That have been also tried are co-firing biomass with other fuels. Coal-fired power plants can fire biomass. Some of the advantages of using biomass is it's lower in sulfur. It can lower sulfur emissions from a plant. It's, again, it's a little more difficult to transport biomass and get it into the combustion chambers. Has been done on a test basis. Let's take a minute to review what the status of some of these biomass activities are in the state of Minnesota. Believe it or not, with all the talk, there are no cellulosic ethanol plants in Minnesota. There are none in the United States that I'm aware of. There are a number of small pilot plants. Many different companies are looking or have plans to build a cellulosic ethanol plant. Most of them appear to be waiting for federal funding or some type of incentive, federal level at least, to start this first cellulosic large scale. Gasification in Minnesota, we do have several examples. The Central Minnesota Ethanol Plant in Little Falls installed a gasifier to run wood and wood waste, and possibly on their DDGs if wood supplies are tight or if the price of DDGs is not sufficient to transport it or sell it, possibly burn that in their gasifier. Plus, in Winnebago, installed a gasifier to burn their syrup from their corn ethanol process. It's been very successfully operated. Say they've lowered their energy costs considerably. That allowed them to install another piece of equipment that ran on natural gas to control their emissions. So they got savings on that. Direct combustion is used on lots of materials from the forest products industry. Typically burn their lignin co-products or their black liquor for heat. Some produce electricity. Some of the OSB mills burn their some of their wire components to produce electricity also. Anaerobic digestion is another energy. Continue with the direct. There's a couple more examples of the poultry litter plant in Benson called Fibromin, set to go into operation to run on poultry litter to produce electricity. Another example very close to here, the St. Paul District Heating. On a combination of coal and some biofuels, mostly collected wood waste. As I mentioned, the paper mills and wood processors typically. Anaerobic digestion is another possibility to produce biofuels. Several operating areas in the state. It's not bottlenecks with anaerobic digestion is the high capital cost. It's usually only considered suitable if you have a free source of biomass or one to dispose of. If you could use it yourself, there could be some economic gains. But to purchase biomass to put in an anaerobic digester, given the present economic conditions, is probably not feasible. Ethanol plants, a few ethanol plants have installed anaerobic digesters to some of their wastewater, methane for their process, and several ag processors, industry use anaerobic digestion to clean up and to produce some of their own energy. And Al Deering.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Al Doring. I work out of the AURI office in Wauseka, Minnesota. I operate the co-products pilot lab there. So we get to do a lot of the hands-on working with groups, getting dirty, those type of projects. The area I wanted to talk about today real quick was the evolving technology for agricultural co-products. Those are the areas that I work in Wauseka. Co-products could be everywhere from wheat straw waste to sunflower hulls. Distillers is considered a co-product. Obviously, technology opportunities for crop residues and these co-products do exist for technologies that were mentioned earlier today, such as cellulosic ethanol, gasification, co-firing, and pellet fuels, which is kind of a new one for today. But many of the projects and a lot of the interest that I see coming into the lab is looking at agricultural co-products as a wood replacement, as the cost of wood continues to climb or becomes more expensive. With the interest in renewable energy, the pellet fuel stoves, a lot of people are looking at using agricultural fibers in those areas. Crop residues offer the greatest biomass quantity, not always quality, but quantity. And what I wanted for everyone on the committee to see is just some of the quantities that we're looking at. If you had 60 bushel per acre wheat, that roughly gives you 2.3 dry ton So that's not a as-is number, but dry ton. If you remove 50%, you roughly have a little over a ton per acre of biomass there available. Wheat is definitely dependent on moisture, and genetics can affect that. For the producers in the group, years ago you used to have wheat that would stand 3-4 feet tall. Groups are breeding it shorter wheat to handle. 150 bushel per acre corn will roughly give you a little over 3 dry ton per acre of corn stover. If you were to remove 50% of that biennially, you roughly have a little over a ton and a half to work with every year. So that's why people look at agricultural biomass definitely as a source. All right. Some of the other areas that co-products and crop residues excel in that would fit some of these opportunities, they're low in moisture content, generally 7 to 15% moisture. The second thing is you have a wide collection window. Some of them provide erosion protection, and there's no additional processing. So when you take a product like sunflower hulls, distillers, wheat mids, through the process they've gone through already, they can easily be transported or blown into a co-firing situation. Going back to the low moisture content, that's where wheat straw excels. Wheat straw is definitely drier than corn stover, which is a negative. When grain is 20% moisture, the stover is generally around 30% moisture. And you know how our falls are in Minnesota. The collection window is an issue. So one thing that straws offer and co-products is a wider collection window. So that's something to keep in mind. Secondly, this was touched on too by the group previous. Crop residues are a source of organic material and a source of carbon. And this was shown on the slides when they were talking about prairie grasses. 75% of new carbon in the soil is root-derived, which was touched on earlier. So most of the carbon that does go back to the soil is through the root system. Right? Some of the current biomass developments, these aren't necessarily current developments, the first one, but one of the things that's critical to make these biomass systems work, whether it's for cellulosic conversion, whether it's for co-firing into a fluidized bed burner, whether it's to collect stover to make a biomass pellet, is you have to know the economics of what's going to cost me to collect the material. And so many times that number is underestimated, or it does not provide profitability for the farmer or an incentive for him to do it. And these numbers are in the range of where a lot of the research has fallen. But in Minnesota, corn stover, it roughly costs $39 to $42 per dry ton to collect it. Wheat straw, right around $30, a little bit over per dry ton. Some of the improvements in efficiency of biomass collection is, number one, we need to increase the feedstock density. We're working in those areas on several projects, and I'll touch on that on the end of my slides here. But another thing some of the equipment dealers are working on is New Holland. They have a baler that actually has a cutter that goes in front of the pickup attachment or the throat of the baler, which some of you may be familiar with. What they're able to do there, John Deere has the same, what they're able to do is they actually pre-cut it out in the field. So instead of making an 800-pound bale, they're making a 1,000-pound bale, which increases transportation costs. It's a spot to make it more economical. Single-pass harvesting is critical. The fewer times you can drive over that field to collect the biomass, obviously that's what's going to save money. And then the storage infrastructure. If going back to cellulosic ethanol, co-firing, what have you, if we collect all the stover, all the biomass to do these projects, there needs to be a place to store them. And that can become an issue. And I know some of the areas, some of the projects have looked at that AURI has dealt with is you leave an incentive in there for the farmer for him to do on-farm storage, and then the industry collects it as needed, which seems to be a economical way to do it. But for all these steps, there has to be profitability left for the farmer to do that. Next thing, current biomass developments. One of the big things is improved genetics for biomass production. Some of the meetings we've attended, people are throwing out numbers like, can we get to 12 ton per acre switchgrass? And I think as these opportunities move forward, and there I targeted switchgrass, there's going to be opportunities in other fields too, but you're going to see these evolving with the genetic companies. One of the other areas, more efficient harvesting, that goes back to the single pass harvesting. But this is kind of a scary thought, but it's something to make you think about. I put down big loaves versus bales. So those of you familiar with farming back in the 70s and early 80s, you remember the big loaves you saw out in the field, which were called stackers, where you just hope you won't get a big windstorm to tear them apart. But when you look at stacking biomass, which probably costs $4.50 per ton versus baling biomass, $12 a ton, it's something to think about, thinking out of the box. Obviously, if you're going to stack material like that, I hope the plant's right next to you, or there's a densification plant because you aren't going to haul that material. And then what I talked about earlier, shredders mounted ahead of the balers. The last two areas I wanted to touch on is as these cellulosic plants are looked at or looking back at projects that AURI is working on, obviously we need improved transportation or an improved infrastructure. Whenever we look at a plant that's bringing in, whether it's a coal product into a coal firing situation or a process similar to that, transportation, having the road system in place, because you are moving a lot of material, a lot of trucks. And finally, improvements in processing equipment. And here's an area of focus that we've been doing quite a bit with in the lab lately. If you are to move this biomass, what is the most efficient way to densify it? You know, obviously you can bale it, make a dense bale, try to utilize the 24-ton you're allowed to ship down the road. Pyrolysis could be a process that the university is working on where you liquefy it at different sites. The other ones we're working on here with a couple groups is looking at pelleting it versus making a briquette out of it. And some of the stuff we're learning is that pelleting may be a little more economical, and that's one of the initiatives we're working on. Looking at the potential of, do you set a group of small pelleters out to where the biomass is, densify it where the biomass is so it's easier to store, it's easier to transport, areas like that. And lastly, new pellet mill designs. In the United States, there's a few manufacturers that make pellet mills. They all run very similar. Just like the one we have in the lab where the die runs vertically. There are companies out there, groups in India, where they do a lot of densification, where they can get threefold the production per horsepower that we can in densifying. And that's technology that's definitely worth looking into. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Dale.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Doering, on the third to the last or fourth to the last page of the handout, you're talking about dry tons of wheat straw and dry tons of corn stover and so forth. And earlier you were talking about like 1.5 tons. You're harvesting half the corn stover, it'd be 1.5 dry tons per acre. And then when you get to the switchgrass page, which is the next one where you're talking about 12 ton per acre switchgrass with a question mark, are you talking 12 tons dry also?
They had claimed that as dry, so everything's compared to on the same basis, and I didn't make that clear. But what I do want to make clear is right now, switchgrass production in Minnesota, you may get 3 to 4 ton per acre. Dry ton, that's the numbers that we see. So that 12 ton per acre was put on there as what's in the future. Is that possible?
Well, then, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Doering, or somebody at the table, could you just give me an idea of how many gallons of ethanol you can get, you think you'll be able to get out of a ton of corn stalks, switchgrass, wheat straw?
Chairman Bickerman, the current technology for cellulosic ethanol ranges from claims, because we don't have 70 to 90 tons or gallons per ton,
70 to 90 gallons of ethanol per ton. Sounds pretty good. I say that sounds pretty good to me.
Good. If that's achievable, though.
Those are projections.
Is there a deal of follow-up? Senator Hahn first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and not sure if any of you are able to answer the question, but I believe one of you, Dr. Moody, talked about that currently there are no cellulosic ethanol plants in Minnesota, and furthermore, there are none in the United States. There's some pilot programs, and so some of the questions that we're asking are going to be tough to answer because there really isn't, a plant that can produce and we can get some of these things. But the question I have is, you mentioned that we didn't have any plants in the United States, you're waiting for some kind of federal money. And I'm wondering where the venture capital markets are. Why aren't they involved in investing in private resources to do this? Why is it dependent on the government source of funding to do this? And with the potential that you seem to be talking about, it seemed to me that a lot of money out there is looking for a home. And,
you're actually getting more.
And bringing this money to market. Again, this may not be a question you're prepared to answer, but I'm just thinking, why would we need to wait for that?
Chairman Bickerman, Senator Hahn. Slide showed the estimates at this time are from 3 to 5 times investment capital required per gallon. So, here is no one's going to build that first one with their own capital. Or at least they haven't to this point. So,
I'm not sure when that's
going to happen. It's been going to happen very soon for a very long time. The economics have changed considerably in the last few years, so I would cautiously optimistic that the first one is going
to get built. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Senator. Dr. Wiene, I believe this question is for you. When you were talking about the biomass opportunities under cellulosic ethanol, I think you said that you expect the ethanol plants to be energy neutral at some point. Did you say that?
Chairman Bickerman, what's your name?
Erickson Ropes.
On a cellulosic fermentation ethanol plant, where it's,
fermented,
there's enough lignin, undigested cellulose left over in the process. It's not fermented. That will be combusted to produce all the energy. That plant requires probably more. It's not carbon neutral, but it's energy neutral for that plant. So.
Is there an expectation at all for ethanol plants to be energy neutral? I was struck when I toured the ethanol plant in Preston, and it was a great tour, and the board of directors was there, the chief engineer, and the president, and we stood outside and watched this gigantic plume of steam, coming out of one of the or out of the top there. And I said, "Well, tell me about this plume of steam." And of course, knowing I'm a Democrat, they said, "Well, they don't have any. There's nothing bad in there." it's not where I was going. At what point are we going to expect the second or third or fourth generations of ethanol plants to capture that steam because they use a lot of water in their processing. Is there a way for us to roll that water back into the system? And then also, it's a lot of lost energy just going straight into the atmosphere. Can't we expect some time to roll that over and capture lost energy and lost water?
Senator, ethanol production process has gotten much more efficient. It's getting better with each new plant that's built. There's very little water going out the stack these days. And very little heat. They need some to drive the process. It's difficult to capture every piece of it. Many of these plants are getting very efficient on water use. They reuse all of their process water, and they're using more of their distillation accent, as they call it, back into their fermentation process. They have very few other places to capture energy other than distillers' dried grain product. Most of the steam that you see is from the dry process, getting the water out of distiller's dried grain so it can be transported. The preferable method would be to move it wet, but many plants don't have close enough markets to just supply it wet.
Members, we have to move along. I'm going to have to take two more questions, and that's it. Make them short. Paul?
Yeah.
Senator Coring, I mean.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to point out what a great sheet this is here, this one that I think we got from the commissioner, and I would point this out to my colleague, Senator Hamm, that government does have a role to help spur economic development. And so if you look at this sheet, it's projected in 2008, just look at the jobs there, 18,461 jobs, and I'd be willing to venture that the income taxes that are paid have probably paid back the money that we invested into the ethanol program. So I believe it is government's job to help spur the economy, and I think that we've done it. I think the legislature and others have done a great job in doing that, and so we have to continue to help our farmers. One just quick question, Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind. When you take all these, the corn stalks off the land, I believe you'd call it humus, that if you plow under it really kind of builds up the soil. If you take all that stuff off of there, how are you able to continually build up the soil, or doesn't that make any difference? I guess I'm just kind of curious on that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's a question that I'm always not real comfortable answering. And if you look at the way I stated the amount of dry matter that you can remove per acre, I stated the 50%, and those are numbers that were tested at Kansas State University and the University of Wisconsin. There's a lot of articles written in the Agronomy Journal about that, but it goes back to what I had said earlier and what we saw in the overhead. I'm a producer also. You see the organic matter. You see the stalks going off. I couldn't envision every year taking the stover off like you do when you remove corn silage. When you start looking at 50%, it may be a possibility, but there's really not been any long-term studies beyond 30 years at what are you doing to that soil. What is known is most of the carbon that is going back to the soil is coming in through the root system. And the research that has been done is when they looked at how much of the plant residue from the top of the surface that went back into the soil is still there in 1 to 2 to 3 years. That's a very small percentage of the organic matter. A lot of it, and this is all stated in an Agronomy Journal, a lot of it's coming from the root system.
Senator Scogin, it's the last question, quickly.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. Not a question for this group, but just Senator Erickson Ropes. That's part of, I think, we have to focus on we're siting some of these plants so that we can use some of that heat and steam to do other jobs. I've got a plant out in North Dakota now that is using some of that to help drive the turbine to help produce electricity. So communities have to know that these plants are coming in and and then they can site them at places where they can use some of that coal.
Thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
Your presentation, I hate to rush you along, but we're supposed to be out of here at 5:30. Senator Farmer legislator. Commissioner, can you come up? I've known Gene so long, I'd like to call him by his first name. I don't know if I can do that. So I'll say Commissioner Hugesson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, Gene Hugesson again. One thing I would say about citing, Senator, is that we've learned, though, don't put one in downtown St. Paul. It's, experience shows that that's probably not necessarily a good idea. Members, what I'd like to just wrap up, and I'll do this very quickly because I want to be respectful of your time situation, is to give you just a kind of a bird's-eye view of where the administration sees this going from our perspective. And I have to be respectful, of course, that the governor will be addressing this somewhat in his State of the State tomorrow and also more distinctly on next Monday in the budget address. But clearly, the governor has made it very clear that Minnesota has been a leader in this whole issue. We intend to remain a leader in this issue as well, not just for the status of being number one or being just the notoriety that goes along with it, because certainly we've had that. We, for instance, get, I would guess, at least one delegation a month from China coming to Minnesota to look at our renewable fuel industry. They go from here to Brazil to talk about their ethanol industry and then back to China, or to Brazil first, then here. So certainly we have attracted a lot of attention, and for good reason. But I think when you look at the long-term economic benefit that this has generated for us and will continue to generate for us, it makes it very important that we do continue to push this issue. And I think it's also very clear that what Minnesota has done and continues to do has spurred other states and even the federal government to sort of get off dead center and start to do some things in this area as well. What we see materializing is as it relates for existing ethanol plants, certainly their fuel costs are one of their major challenges. Natural gas prices are high and getting higher, and will probably continue to do so. Also, as if you remember the comment that Senator Chaudhry raised as it relates to how do we get the amount of material we need to be able to use that in the conversion into cellulose, it seems to us to make sense that you do this in a two-step process that addresses both of these issues. In other words, there are a number of plants that are already looking at how can we use some biomass material to provide the energy to make our existing ethanol out of corn and soybeans. Why not then have the state encourage our other facilities to move in this direction as well? It begins the process for how we are encouraging farmers and various groups to start producing biomass material on a larger basis so that there is a market that develops for it, to ramp up the program in such a way that when we do get to the point of being able to make ethanol out of biomass material, out of cellulose material, we have a supply that has been built up, sort of a situation of providing the market. At the same time, we're increasing the production too, so that they work together and that we're not trying to get one ahead of the other. So we will see some ideas that will come out in the budget that will incentivize or look at moving in that particular direction. Certainly, I mentioned before, the agencies that we've been working with, DNR will become a major player with us as we work in that whole issue as well. Earlier, I think Dr. Tillman was talking about the idea of using CRP land for moving in some of this direction. And we think that's a great idea, too. In fact, I've had conversations with Congressman Peterson about the idea that the next farm bill needs to include the ability for CRP land to have a dual function. Not only because it makes sense economically, but I would also suggest that if the government does not look at doing this, they're going to see a sharp decrease in the amount of land that will go into CRP and for the state into CREP down the road, simply because economics will dictate that instead that land go into corn or soybeans or wheat, not into a set-aside like the CRP. So it only makes sense that if we're going to have conservation programs down the road that are environmentally friendly, we come up with some means of dual use here so that you can responsibly and do the harvest in a way that is managed in a way to preserve for the conservation purposes, but also increase the mass by which you can use here to also provide the product for doing cellulose. I would comment on the question about the cover for the corn stover. The plant that is being built down in Iowa, they are only going to take one-third of the corn stalks off that field as a means of preserving that cover. At the same time, they are using the corn stalks for the ethanol production. Beyond that, where we are going is looking at the governor's proposal, what we will for now dub the next-gen project, meaning for the next generation as to where we're going with the whole idea of renewable fuels. What the state can and should be doing to encourage the whole promotion of and or going into cellulosic ethanol. Our belief is that there will be some what I would describe as very healthy incentivization moving in that direction. Our goal is not to compete with what's out there right now and not to necessarily take up all the money for anything having to do with agriculture, but looking at this as a means of coming up with a program that will allow encourage the movement into cellulosic ethanol production in a way that provides us some flexibility. One of the concerns that we have is that we do not want to come up with a proposal and legislation that locks us into a particular mode at this point because, frankly, as I mentioned earlier, we are several years away from probably being in a commercialization of ethanol from cellulose, and we don't want to put a program in place right now that's going to dictate us going some area and not having the flexibility to move. So what we would envision happening here is that we will have some incentivization that will look at partnering with other private investors. This isn't going to be a big grant that's going to build a plant by any means. This will be a means of trying to be the encourager for the lending institutions to get behind and use some of that investor capital that is available, encouraging farmer ownership again, because this is a priority for the governor, knowing that that's what's worked well in rural Minnesota. We need to preserve that concept and move ahead. And I would also suggest that we might want to look very carefully at a program from the state's perspective, that if we are, in fact, going to be investing this money in some of these facilities, that we protect it in such a way so that once that money is invested, it's not turned around and sold off to some private entity later on, and the state, in essence, loses that investment from its original intention. So I think there's going to be a number of things that we look ahead here in doing that it's going to require a good working effort between the administration and certainly the legislature. Mr. Chairman, Senator Vickerman, I have to tell you, I'm very encouraged by the enthusiasm and participation of this committee on this issue. I happen to believe, and I, as you know, most of you know anyway, that I've been on this job for now over 11 years, maybe 12 years. And it's in the whole time that I've been here, this is probably the most exciting time I've seen for agriculture in terms of where we're going. Senator Vickerman, Senator Dill, we've been around here looking at some very tough times for agriculture when things look kind of bleak. We're on the cutting edge of some very exciting things that agriculture is going to take part in, and I really think it's going to be a good time for us to be working together and look forward to it. It's probably the best year ever in terms of the kinds of things that we're facing. So I think we can have a lot of fun, do a lot of exciting things. Again, the governor's committed to moving ahead with this. He chaired the Governor's Ethanol Coalition and made this a big priority. Next year, he assumes the leadership of the National Governors Association, and so we're going to be seeing this become also a national issue in more ways than we even have up to this point. So, I probably shouldn't go into any more detail than that, other than just to say that it's going to be very exciting. The governor, as you know, has endorsed the 25 by 25 concept. So we're talking about 25% of our energy coming from renewables. That's talking about electricity as well. So the kinds of things that we're going to be doing in that area also will be very good for agriculture and our potential.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. We'll be listening patiently tomorrow to see what's in this speech. At least I will. Thank you very much.
I look forward to coming back and sharing things in more detail after it's released.
Well, Commissioner, this whole group here is willing to work with the governor and your department to see what we can move this process ahead. And I think I can speak for everybody. We need to work together.
Mr. Chair, individually or collectively, anything we can do from our office to help answer any of your questions, some of our people are still here. Quinn Cheney, our legislative policy person, Joe Martin, assistant commissioner behind the post, is here. Ralph Groshen was here and left just a few minutes ago. So we will work with you in every way we can.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Members, Thursday, 3 o'clock, there's another part of this committee that's just as important as ag, as far as I'm concerned, is veterans. And we're going to bring up the veterans' home and the problems that's been at that veterans' home that we thought we corrected in a meeting a year ago. And I know the House, not the House, the Senate Health and Human Services had their part of the bill, but I wasn't, I just caught bits of it on TV. So I want that group, the home board, to come before this committee, because this committee is the one that's going to have to fund it if they need money to keep that place straightened up. And absolutely no excuse in what's going on there. Not going to accept that. We gave them a year to change it. Nothing. They still had 36 counts against them. So I want to hear, and I want you to ask questions. What are we doing? What can we do? And what is going on out there? Because it really puts a bad impression on the whole state of Minnesota. When we have the other ones, Laverne, no checks, Fergus Falls, way up north, that just five of them had no checks, and this should be the biggest and the best, 36 fractions. Now, you can say to me, well, some of those were minor. I don't care. Just simply this. Would you want to be in no clothes and go in the bathroom with the door wide open? God, I don't even let my wife in the bathroom when I've been married 56 years. I mean, how embarrassing that can be to a soldier or a veteran. That's unacceptable. We're not going to, that's got to be changed. And if it doesn't, I've got a couple things back in my mind that they don't know about, but we'll listen and see how they're going to do and see what the problem is. And I want you to be here, especially because I believe your profession, you are a nurse or was a nurse?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm a nurse and a veteran.
Okay, that's important, so we can kind of follow both sides of that issue. Okay, with that, sorry, members, I got a little late, but it's a very important subject, and hopefully with the other one, we'll be out by 5:30. So, again, thank you very much. Now, I'll help you.